You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
Good morning and welcome to Friday's OTB AM. It's Adrian Barry with you on this Friday morning. Owen Chen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What's happening?
Not much. Yourself?
Not a lot. We've a nicely stacked show. We'll talk to people about that in just a few minutes' time. We're not that well prepared, I feel, this morning. Is that accurate enough?
No, not at all. I come in here prepared meticulously every Friday morning.
The same level of accuracy as we normally have.
Well, exactly. You can speak for yourself this morning, Adrian, I think.
The big one this weekend, Owen?
The big one being?
Kerry's dominance to continue at pace.
In football, in senior football.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Is there any other...
As has been mentioned in a couple of the newspapers this morning, the fact that the All-Ireland champions of 2019 not being involved in the league final isn't a great sign for the league. You want the team who eventually win the All-Ireland to be playing in the league final. And given the fact that Dublin are going to win the All-Ireland this year at a canter, the fact that they're missing from this weekend's clash is probably a bit of a disappointment for neutrals in general, really.
That's the only significant counterpoint to the disappointment about Dublin not being involved, that maybe they're not Dublin anymore.
What, the five in a row achieving Dublin?
Possibly, they're possibly not.
You're not backing them 2-6?
I don't know. Look, all evidence over the last number of years suggests that they are going to do that, but they've been shaky during the league this time in a way that we haven't really typically seen from them before. Is that going to sort of unleash some doubts in this Dublin team? And I know I only know your patter and your spiel here about that, yeah, it's only the league and... Yeah, they'll be grand, and yeah, sure, even if Kerry win it, sure, look, it's a long old summer ahead, and sure, the sun's hardly out, and yeah, sure, look, Dublin will be back, etc, etc, etc.
The championship is an entirely different season.
Oh, sure, you're looking at
a month off.
They're at the championship, sure, it's a different ball game entirely, almost.
No, it is. It's literally a different competition, and it's months. It's like 15 weeks between the two competitive games. And I say competitive in inverted commas because I do play amongst the championship in between.
Big giant inverted commas. You're going this weekend, obviously, are you?
Yes.
Are you working at it, or are you?
No, I'll be at it as a person rather than a journalist, as a human rather than a journalist.
All right, the fake news media. Very good. We do have a stack show. We're going to talk. I've spent a lot of my. Last 24 hours attempting to re-watch the Ireland-Georgia game from during the week, which itself has been an experience. All the vein of research, you'll understand. Not something I would choose to do in my sort of just general run-of-the-mill week. Been largely frustrated by the RT player, actually, was one of the sort of... I would have had it done in a couple of hours. It took me mostly yesterday.
Why did it take like ad breaks in the middle of the half and stuff?
The ad breaks are not great, but they're definitely not the worst of it. Just tends to freeze a lot. Freeze, crash, and then hit you with 5 minutes of ads again.
Yes, very frustrating. If you're not watching it all in one sitting, you basically need a high-powered computer and some sort of futuristic video card on it to actually experience it flawlessly.
But I was re-watching Seamus Coleman's performance specifically. It's been a bit of a hot topic behind the scenes and off the ball towers this week. I think mainly it did bubble over a little bit when I think Nathan spoke to John Giles about it last night. But I was minding my own business at home last night when I got a text from a former Ireland international who may or may not have played for Everton as well, inquiring as to, who hadn't been involved in this conversation in any way, shape or form, but inquiring as to what was happening at the show this morning about Seamus Coleman.
Mm. And what is happening on the show this morning about Seamus Coleman, and why has he got word about it?
Well, that's I can't answer that part of the question, although I could take a stab at it. No, we're just kind of... It came up in the office during the week about how Seamus Coleman had performed against Georgia during the week, and I had having been at the game, a very different take, it seems, than, I suppose, some of the, in inverted commas, great football people around the department kind of felt that he was... Our offtheball.com had given him a 7 out of 10, and it seemed like most of our great football people, Nathan Murphy, our football commentator, and Phil Egan, one of the great football voices around Off the Ball as well, had all sort of generally concurred that it was a 7 out of 10, maybe an 8 out of 10. He'd done really well. One of his top 10 performances in an Ireland shirt... was what Nathan Murphy announced during the week.
God, he didn't even get an 8.
I really couldn't agree with, I have to say. And so I decided I'd watch the game back and do a bit of analysis of it, and that's what I've done, and it's going to be coming our way at some point a bit later today.
I get the sense that you're not giving him a 7 out of 10.
Do you know what? It wasn't as bad as I thought. It was probably one of my primary thoughts that I went at it with enough of an open mind to be able to say now that it wasn't as bad as I thought. Mm. It wasn't great. It definitely wasn't in his top 10. He's not in his highlights reel, that's for sure. And there's a lot of bad stuff in it. Some good stuff. Happy to sort of accept that. So we've done a deep dive, is what's happened on.
God, you've really whetted the appetite for this now. You've kind of said, I'm about to tell you what I think of Seamus Coleman, and then you've kind of pulled
then
the carrot away.
Good. Well, hopefully I'll be able to sort of see that out when it actually comes to doing the piece that we've, you know, rehearsed for the last 4 hours.
So, Walt, can you tell us what rating out of 10 you would give Seamus Coleman the other night?
My rating of Seamus Coleman would probably be a 4.5. Four, leaning towards 4, really, but probably about a 4.5.
So 4. Yeah. On whole numbers, if you can't pick a decimal point, it'll be 4 out of 10.
4.5 is what I'm doing. I'm allowed to do what I want. Having dedicated that level of my life to this particular topic over the last 24 hours, I'm allowed to do it whatever it is I want.
Wow, okay. I haven't seen too many people say that there was anybody on the pitch in a green shirt last night that were 4.5 out of 10.
He was in good company, is the other thing. It's not.
Oh, yeah?
Look at
who else?
One of the biggest takeaways from the game during the week was that Ireland did look decent, and we at times definitely played a bit of ball, and I think Shane Duffy was really good. Glenn Whelan was excellent. Obviously McGoldrick was again even better actually than I thought he was. He was excellent, and obviously I think got man of the match, and was better again than I'd watched it. But there was a load of just average performances of players who at times did some okay stuff and then at times did some very bad stuff. Robbie Brady obviously amongst them, Jeff Hendrick amongst them, and Coleman definitely falls into that category as well, so yeah.
And would they fall below the 5 out of 10 boundary, Hendrick and Brady?
I'd probably put 5 out of 10 for both of them.
Right, okay. That's pretty disappointing for a team that I would have thought had put in one of their better performances.
They were playing two Bob Rovers, as far as I'm concerned. Georgia showed no ambition or capacity or ability really to get into the game at all. They were terrible. I thought they were shocking. What do you think?
Well, like you were there, I'm only an armchair fan.
Well, what did you watch it?
I did, of course.
What did you think?
I was disappointed with Georgia. Disappointed is the wrong term, because I was delighted with them, to be honest with you. I thought that they, at times, showed an ability to play a bit of football against Switzerland on Saturday, and that kind of didn't really come to fruition too much during the week. Like, I do think the elephant in the room here is just that Ireland were magnificent relative to how Ireland have been over the last 2 years.
You say that, right? And they hit the upright in the last, whatever it was, 10 or 15 minutes, and could have left with a draw.
I made that point the other morning, is that if you want to be realistic about it, and it's not being negative about it, it's being realistic about it, is that Ireland played, I don't want to say out of their skin, Ireland played extremely well, and it was above their average bar from the end of the Martin O'Neill era, no question about that. Yeah. And they still beat the second bottom seed in their group 1-0, and one of their efforts hit off the post. We weren't flawless at the back. We allowed them to create a couple of chances. Ireland need to play well above themselves to take anything away from home against Denmark or Switzerland, and probably to take anything at home against Switzerland.
Yeah, I'm not closing the idea that actually Mick McCarthy's only a couple of competitive games into his reign. It was average enough opposition, get the job done. Obviously, the Gibraltar game was a bit of a write-off for a load of different reasons. I'm not sort of discounting the fact that maybe actually there's a bit of a trajectory here with Mick McCarthy and things can improve, but the signs are definitely there more than they were before his arrival, for sure, that Ireland can, like, there was a load of football. Football broke out from an Irish point of view the other night at times. Like, I saw somebody make the point that if that Hendrick goal that he just slightly wandered offside for had gone in, it would have been one of the best passing goals that Ireland have scored in years. And I can get on board with all of that. I just think there are also, let's not sort of, I suppose my major point this morning is, and talk about a bit more detail about the Coleman one, let's not just get totally carried away and say that that's something that's definitely going to happen, or Ireland have suddenly sort of turned a corner to be this great footballing team. Like, we have to sort of countenance that a small bit, and that's kind of what I'm going to do a bit later on.
Well, I look forward to it. Mm. My appetite is sated. Not yet, actually. There will be.
Here's what's coming up on the show this morning. We're going to tell you what's happening in the back pages very shortly. We're going to talk Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Liverpool-Tottenham as well, in the company of Daniel Harris. That is just after 8 o'clock. The mailbag is coming your way. That's apparently some interesting contacts during the week. Some abuse for Owen, I'm sure. and that'll be about 8:30. Darren Cleary, for the very last time, is going to join Off the Ball for the sports news this morning. We'll give him a bit of a send-off there just after 8:30 as well. We're going to talk Heineken Champions Cup at 9:15. Alan Quinlan's in studio, and we'll also get his reaction to the fact that Joey Carberry has extended his loan deal with Munster. So that is about 9:15 or thereabouts, and obviously such a big weekend of Heineken Champions Cup rugby as well, so plenty to talk to Quinny about there. Seamus Coleman, some analysis of his performance against Georgia, as we've been discussing, that is just after 9:00, and we'll also get stuck into the league finals as well for the weekend after about 9:15 or thereabouts. So we do want to hear from you this morning as well. Hashtag OTBAM, drop us a comment, and we'll be delighted to bring it to the audience. But right now, time for the papers. So we're going to kick off with the back page of the Irish Sun here. It's win back title or I'll give you the boot. Ole gets a United job and he issues a warning to his players. He's keen that they get the job done here. That is the main story and on the Sun this morning and tends to occupy a lot of the papers.
Back page of the Mirror is I'm going to make United great again. Solskjaer targets first league crown since 2013 after landing dream job. And you've also got Paul O'Hare writing that Delaney FAI loan is under scrutiny. So Minister Shane Ross says John Delaney's €100,000 raises serious questions about governance and financial controls in the FAI. And another politician last night claimed that the entire FAI board is existing on borrowed time.
The Irish Independent this morning, there are also a couple of themes that crop up here. The main photograph, obviously, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. FAI face fine over protest against, as provinces back Delaney, on the back of a couple of statements yesterday. David Kelly writing there in the Irish Independent. And one of the big pieces of news this morning from a rugby point of view, as you can see here, Sexton a doubt as Leinster ring the changes, but Carberry set for Munster return. So these are big pieces of news for both of these provinces that could dictate the outcome of one game or the other.
Back page of the Herald is I'm open for business. Solskjaer banking on lure of Reds to snare big summer transfer targets. And Richard Dunn is writing about a new dawn at Old Trafford as well. He says Ole can lead United back to glory days.
The Irish Times this morning has big old picture of Michael Checa there, who was over at the Off the Ball Heineken Rugby Club outside broadcast at the Olympia during the week, and his thoughts ahead of what's a monster weekend of rugby in Leinster season. So that's the thoughts of Michael Checa there. Matt Williams as well, his analysis there in the Irish Times. An upbeat friend says stays positive ahead of daunting test, one of the most intriguing games of the weekend. It's on tonight, in fact, in the Challenge Cup as well, in the quarterfinals there. So we will talk to Quinny about that too a little bit later.
Leading the way in the Irish Examiner Sports Supplement is Joey Carberry there on the training ground in Munster. Tyler Blaendell just behind him. Spring in their step, says the headline. It's Roland O'Gara's column that says keeping Carberry to 2022 is the best piece of Munster business since tying down Conor Murray. Risky business is the headline then surrounding Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Why did United decide to appoint Solskjaer now, they ask. Brendan O'Brien has been writing about Matt Doherty and how he's been poorly served by his country. And Paul Ralph says, what's rare is wonderful when it comes to county success. He's got a brilliant historical column on Leitrim football this morning in the Irish Examiner.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer also on the front page of the sports section of the Irish Daily Star this morning. Grassroots backing for Delaney is a theme that's also picked up by Paul Lennon here. We mentioned a couple of statements that were released yesterday, but one of the most interesting pieces I haven't seen in any of the other ones here is by Paul Brown. Manuel Rice has his price, which is a contender for Tab of the Morning. Manuel Pellegrini's warned the Manchester clubs they'll have to break the bank if they want to sign Declan Rice. So this is good news for Declan Rice because it's going to bump up his money one way or the other.
The back page of the Times this morning is Now Let's Win the Title. It's a quote from Solskjaer, who challenges his players to land the Premier League. They've appointed him until 2022 in a bargain deal. And controversy over support for Delaney. This is regarding the local support that John Delaney has received from Peter Doyle at Leinster, Gerry Tully in Connacht, Gerard Laney in Munster and Herbie Barr in Ulster. So Tully is a firm ally of Delaney, rising to his feet at the annual general meeting in 2016 to laud him for embellishing the image of Irish football. And that's how that piece tends to go.
The Irish Daily Mail this morning, it's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as well. We will win the title, he says. Solskjaer vows to make United top dogs again, writes Chris Wheeler there. Kane says that England will walk over racist abuse. This is further follow-on from the racist abuse picked up by some of the England players in their game against Montenegro during the week. And Harry Kane now saying they'll walk off the pitch if this continues, if it's repeated again. And 45 grand is the number that Philip Quinn has put on the potential FAI fine over the tennis ball protest at that game during the week.
The front page of the Racing Post sees the Queen feeding carrots to Frodon. And Smith has national encore in sight with Clouds, says the main story here. So this is Vintage Clouds moving significantly closer to making the cut for the Grand National, price at around 14 to 1 at the moment. And the back page of the Racing Post is Blue Friday, baggies the pylon misery from Midland rivals. It's West Brom against Birmingham at 8 o'clock on Sky Sports. And United 8 to 1 for 2019-20 title after Ole signs up for 3 years.
All right, that is the almost all the newspapers for the Irish News. We'll just take one quick check on that. O'Neill slams Mindless Idiots. This, I'm assuming, having seen it for the first time, is the chatter on the back of those pub chants during the week, is it?
Yeah, We Hate Catholics, yeah. The chant that... Yeah, that's what Michael Neal has been referring to. The only story in town this morning, which you want to start with, is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. We'll bring you The Guardian and The Telegraph back pages as well, because presumably they're leading with that. Ole's at the wheel, says the story here in The Guardian. It has always been my ultimate dream, and Solskjaer at the wheel. I'll bring back title to Old Trafford, promises new permanent manager. So, there's been a couple of angles on this morning across the newspapers. We'll get Daniel Harris's take very shortly indeed. There has been a few dissenting voices to Solskjaer's appointment. Dissenting is probably a strong word, just people offering a counter-opinion to the appointment of Solskjaer. Matt Dickinson, the chief sports writer in The Times this morning, talks about, you know, the fact that you can't properly judge a manager until a crisis. So the jury is still out on Solskjaer properly, in his view. He's somebody who's been supporting Pochettino for the job and reckons that he would have been the prime candidate for it. And that does Solskjaer have the killer instinct to kind of turn things around when the going gets tough or gets tougher in a while. Now, he talks about as well, did this interesting angle about what the football club is and what the aims are of the Glazer family and the hierarchy at Manchester United. And he cites Louis van Gaal in his BBC interview this week, saying that unfortunately, we are talking about a commercial club, not a football club. And in Matt Dickinson's opinion, Solskjaer is almost the perfect commercial appointment for Manchester United. That he's suggesting that potentially if these were cold-hearted, ruthless winners, and all the Glazer family wanted to do was win trophies and go for the title every single year, they might have considered another appointment. Whereas now, you've got a win-win. You've got somebody that the fans love, that the club seems to love, and that probably isn't going to drop out of the top six anytime soon, because he is, as we've seen, at the very worst, a relatively good manager. So he says, yesterday it was a good day for Glazer, simply in making United more appealing, but it is definitely not the same as putting the fear into the club's rivals at home and abroad. Which, I guess, ties in with Solskjaer's personality. Just because he's a nice guy, just because he seems to deal with the media in a very friendly way, doesn't mean that behind closed doors he can have a ruthless streak as well. And I'm sure that will be called into action over the next couple of months, particularly at the start of next season, when new players, because inevitably it's going to be a busy transfer window, start to integrate themselves within the United squad. So there are a couple of counter opinions, but generally across the newspapers this morning, the theme is, this is a great moment for Manchester United. This is really when they can start moving away from the Alex Ferguson era, because it's really been the shadow of Alex Ferguson for the last few years.
I'd have some sympathy for the idea that, for some counterpoints to this, I suppose, I was in some ways surprised that it hadn't happened sooner. It would have been one of the main things that, you know, they might have done it a month ago when things were absolutely flying. And they've taken that decision now. You assume it was something they had never planned for initially, right? Like, this was never... The reason it's taken them so long is that this was never part of the plan. It was that Solskjaer would come in, steady the ship, be gone again by the end of the season, nobody lose any sleep, would have done a fine job. Whatever, you know, we've said this before, but you or I probably could have gone in after Mourinho and done a better job. So, there is that. Look, that isn't to discount Solskjaer as a good manager. That's not what I'm saying. But I think that the shit show that had happened during Mourinho's time, that anybody really could get in afterwards. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's interesting timing. You say it's win-win. It's potentially win-win-lose, obviously, depending on what happens over the next while. And like the point that Matt Dickinson is making, we don't know the answer to a lot of that stuff yet. Like, we don't know if Solskjaer is going to have a good eye for a player in the transfer window. That'll be a huge factor in whether this thing ends up being successful or not. Looking back on some of his Cardiff signings, one piece that I'd read this morning was that he'd made 17 signings during his time at Cardiff City, and there was a lot of flops in there. Now, whether that was above or below the general average of your average Premier League or football manager, I don't know, but there was a lot of bang average players who put in bang average performances for him. He'll be dealing clearly with a slightly different budget, a slightly different pot of cash this time when it comes to landing a few players. So a lot of things remain to be seen, I suppose, is the point. And I wouldn't in any way, shape or form assume that... by the way, I don't think top six is anywhere near good enough for United on an ongoing basis. I think that he sets...
But on a commercial level, is it?
I mean, I don't know.
It probably...
I would say probably not in the longer term. I would say probably not.
It keeps you tipping over for the time being, on an ongoing basis, granted, it's not. But it's not a disaster the way it used to be, given the way television rights have taken over from Champions League revenues as the chief... sort of engine behind your financial model based on what happens on the pitch.
If
Champions League,
if all he does
huge.
Is get top six for the next couple of seasons, he won't see a couple of seasons.
Yeah, true. The thing is, this season could well be a top six finish for Manchester. His first finish could be a top six finish, but you can blame Mourinho for that.
Yeah, but the difficulty is that when he came in, everybody went, they'll finish in the top six and they're getting top four and that's fine. Whereas now it's like, well, they need to kind of get top four for his for this to be seen as a success. Andy Mitten was telling you guys during the week that. So I think there's a lot of variables and there's a lot of unknowns, but the timing of it is interesting. Like, why wouldn't they have just at this stage held off until the end of the season? See, did they get top four?
Yeah, I don't know. I was well behind the idea that they just needed to appoint him now. Like, why not? Why did I wait? Why string the whole thing out and leave him hanging? Like, his contract was up in Mulder. I mean, there is sort of a sense of decorum about it. It's like, you've proved yourself. And also, we can start now putting plans in place for actually acquiring summer targets. If you have an interim manager all the way up until May, and let's face it, a lot of the talk about summer targets is going to be happening right now.
Yeah.
And really, players will be asking, well, who's my manager going to be if I join the club? Yeah. At least now they can come up with a definite answer and say it's going to be Solskjaer.
About that, do they?
I don't know. The way
we're doubling your wages, huge transfer fee, let's get her on.
I don't know, the way his predecessor managed to stagger a few careers, it was interesting. So I would say that the manager is very, very important.
One of the other stories that we wanted to hit on was the in the Sun this morning, and it's just a further beat in the story in relation to John Delaney's governance of the FAI. This was Nadia was flown over from LA to dance with John. All of her expenses were paid. It seems like her flights and expenses were paid. This is the model and singer Nadia Ford. A number of years ago, there was a charity gig held here, and she was flown in from LA to dance with the then FAI chief executive John Delaney as part of this charity drive. And I suppose the FAI would argue that her attendance beefed up the celebrity of the event and their capacity obviously to raise money for some charities. And there isn't any sum of money mentioned over the course of the piece, and it's just, as I said, another beat in this story that refuses to disappear off the news and sports pages.
John Giles was a judge on the night, which
John
I didn't
Giles
know.
Was a judge on the night. Brian from Come Dancing with the Stars.
Dancing with the Stars,
that's
yeah.
That's the one. Was a judge on the night.
Yeah.
And Barry Egan, the journalist, was
filmmaker.
And filmmaker was a judge on the night as well, so yeah. If you got the call on, do you want to come over and sort of get involved?
To dance with John Delaney. 100%. If I got the call and say from John Delaney, say, do you want to, I'll fly you over from LA to come dance with me, you'll be like, 100% John.
Let's do it.
Anything for a mate. Will you move on to the final story you want to touch on this morning? It's a GAA story. We will get into a bit of Gaelic games later on, but Paul Rouse has just got this really fantastic piece in the Irish Examiner this morning, all his brilliance on historical elements of storylines, and one of the big storylines so far this year has been the story of Leitrim. And it is kind of unfortunate when you look at the story to think that, isn't it a shame that this is the secondary competition? Like, this is based on meritocracy, this is based on teams playing other teams of a similar level, and you get brilliant storylines and an appearance at Croke Park and all that sort of stuff, which really we need to be promoting a little bit more. But anyway, Paul Rouse goes into the history of Leitrim, and of course the population of Leitrim is something that's spoken about, and we know in the 19th century how populations got ravaged everywhere, but the figures are still stark. So the 1841 census in Leitrim recorded a population of 155,000 people. Just 10 years later, that had fallen to 112,000 people. Then you get into the 20th century and the population had gone down to 69,000, 51 to 28,000, and then really you get to the mid 1990s, which it gets to its lowest point and has climbed just back to above 32,000 at the moment. So, like, we talk about counties and the vast differences in one county to another on a national level, but even within the province of Connacht, for example, it kind of puts into context just how remarkable their 94 success was in Connacht, which you mentioned. So that was obviously their second Connacht title. The first one, I've never heard the story before, was in 1927. So it was the Connacht Championship. Leitrim faced Roscommon, first of all. The match was won with a goal, Leitrim against Roscommon, which sent hats and caps skywards, Paul Rouse writes. However, Roscommon filed an appeal after that match based on the grounds that the pitch was too small in Carrick and Shannon. Mm. So Leitrim beat Roscommon to progress to the next round of the Connacht Championship, and Roscommon are like, hold on a minute, that pitch was way too small. We want a replay. And they get the replay. So they get to the replay. It was a terrible day, and then there was further drama because Roscommon don't have enough players. So they go to the crowd and they get two Rossies from the crowd to fill in and class. Play on the day. So naturally, I don't want to disrespect the 1927 team of Leitrim this morning, but all I'm saying is that they came up against a team which had a couple of players in the crowd in Roscommon. So they got that bit of luck. They got into the Connacht final, and
Leitrim did.
They beat that.
Where was the replay played?
Ballinamore.
Right.
June 26, 1927. No, Ballinamore is in Leitrim.
Is it?
Your geographical knowledge of
so the first game was played in Carrick and Shannon, was that it?
Yes.
And then the second game was in the bigger
pitch.
They
went to the vast expanses of Ballinamore due to the small pitch in Carrick and Shannon. So the Connacht final, this is interesting, I didn't know this, this might be well known. Leitrim enrolled the services of James O'Hare, who is the father of Micheál O'Hare.
Right.
And he, of course, trained the Clare Hurlers to win the All-Ireland Hurling Championship back in 1914.
I did not know that.
I say, of course, as if like I knew this information, didn't know this. They hammer Galway in the final, 2-4 to 3 points. And the key moment, Paul Rouse writes, was when Willie Flynn scored Leitrim's second goal by putting ball and custodian into the net. So you can only imagine how that ball was bundled over the line. So Leitrim in their first ever Connacht Championship, their only one with the exception of 1994, which we all know the story of. I won't get into that. But then you will get into the semi-final, and I'll finish up on this point. It was politely deemed a physical affair. The semi-final was against Kerry, and it was played in Tuam. It was a game marked by tackling that, even by the standards of the day, was remembered as ferocious. This was accommodated by the match referee, who chose a discreet style. He stayed out of controversy, ironing over awkward situations by getting the two players involved to shake hands. A good man's game, I'd imagine. They lost the game on a scoreline of 4-2. So that was the end of the Leitrim dream in 1927. Rouse says that it's the greatest team in Leitrim's history, but it could have been better, because in 1926, key players John McGoldrick, Willie Daly, Nipper Geelan and John McGuinness had all been lost to emigration. And as I say, he mentions the team in the 90s. The other thing which I didn't know is apparently the Leitrim team of the late 50s and early 60s was an outstanding team. They qualified for four consecutive Connacht finals from 57 right the way through to 1960. But of course, at that time, Galway were becoming a powerhouse. They were about to become one of the greatest Gaelic football teams of all time. And Leitrim just came up against them every single year and got beaten by them every single year. So who knows what would have happened if Galway didn't have such a purple patch at that period. You might have had three great Leitrim teams.
Like the latter-day Mayo.
Well, exactly. Well, you know, that's a good comparison.
Or Kerry, you might argue.
let's leave that Kerry comparison there. that's basically the thrust of the piece.
Right.
Brilliant. It's worth thinking out. There's much more in it.
4-2. I wonder was it if you score a goal. So if you'd scored 117 points and I'd scored one goal, I would win the game rule. I wonder, was that in place at that time or not? Like, suggest 4-2 suggested it might not have been. If it didn't matter what you scored. But if you'd scored 700 points and I'd scored a goal. I would win the game.
Well, 4-2 would suggest that they might have been going for goals all game and they never got any.
Maybe, that's true.
And that's why there were so many, points notched on. That was a bizarre rule at the time. Like, you'd imagine, like, when you complain about blanket defences, like, if football hadn't evolved to this point, like, we'd be reading Joe Brolly columns in the Sunday Independent, listening to Niall Moylan, and it's like, geez, I wonder, should we, you know, change the rule about the goal being, like, catching the snitch
and
in Harry
Potter.
And the
fact that they gave it so much importance, it coming from association football, you would have thought was, it would have gone the opposite way.
Get rid of the nets altogether.
You did start off that piece by saying, lastly from us for the minute, we did want to talk also about Colm Key's piece in the Independent this morning.
Yes.
I know that it was something you were sort of, you were keen to brush over, I suppose, is kind of the point.
But sure, this game is pointless on Sunday.
Keane's case for the defence at the heart of Kingdom rebuild, writes Colm Keyes here, that Peter Keane essentially has done such a brilliant defensive job with his team that they're a couple of good stats that were here. The lowest goal concession rate since the two they coughed up in the final two relegation games in 2009, conceding just four goals on. So the defence is as mean as hell, and they've a load of clean sheets as well in a way that they had never done before. This sort of really defensive style, it turns out, really suits Kerry football?
No, that's not what I've heard this week. I've heard that they've lacked the collective will to defend properly. They don't really have a system in place. And apparently Paul Murphy isn't fit to even wear the jersey of a sweeper. Oh, sorry, it's not called a sweeper. It's called some sort of weird thing.
You're being sort of facetious and pointed against somebody who's here not here to defend themselves. So,
well, I'm just giving a counterpoint to that piece.
I know, but you did that during the week.
Right, you're basically bigging up Kerry's defence.
I'm saying that this defensive football, like, it's taken them whatever it is, 150 years or however long the association's in existence, to realise that they should just play like Galway have started to play now and just be a bit more defensive minded. And
are you saying that they're playing like Galway, or is Colin Peace saying they're playing like
football?
Galway?
Me,
right? Okay,
I'm saying it's a good thing for Kerry. They should sort of
What's the basis
of
play like Galway?
Well, I'm just saying this defensive outlook that has resulted in more clean sheets than they've had in a number of years at this time of the year, fewer goals conceded than they've had for the last 10 years at this stage. 10, I think, conceded in last year's league.
Yeah.
Only 4 this time around. Like, defensive football suits Kerry people.
So, it is you saying that. Okay, fair enough. Because I would have thought that reputable journalist Colm Keyes had said that Kerry are playing like Galway, in which case I would have argued the point, but it's only you.
I didn't say they were playing. I said it would suit them if they were more Galway-minded.
I'm not sure about that. Just because they have...
Take a leaf out of Galway's book.
Because they have a better defence and they have flirted with the idea of playing a blanket defence and have implemented a blanket at certain times this year doesn't mean they're going to pursue it for the future. Looking at the market for this week, it's remarkable to see that Mayo are such outsiders for Sunday, given the way they went down to Tralee a couple of weeks ago and bossed Kerry in the middle of the park. Mm. Kerry have no David Moran still this weekend. Mayo still have their midfield fit. I'd be very surprised to see Mayo not dominate that area of the pitch once again. And once you dominate midfield, you've got a fantastic chance. It just shows the power that David Clifford has in the market, that he really is the only addition to that Kerry team since that game down in Tralee. And I'm not going to lie, we'll give them a better chance of beating them this time. But also, playing it in Tralee should have given Kerry a better chance. So maybe those two things balance themselves out. Mayo to win on Sunday.
Is there...
What?
Is there an email sent out?
Oh, At key points of
the year, is there an email sent out to everyone at Kerry.com saying, here, if you get into any conversation with somebody outside of Kerry, particularly if it's in the broadcast medium, here are 5 to 10 bullet points of reasons that it's only the sun isn't hardly out, and sure, it's only the league, and let's not get carried away with ourselves.
A couple of weeks ago, I had my tail between my legs after a horrendous prediction about Dr. Crokes being superior to Cara Finn, which I got badly wrong. Hmm. So, like, this is just pure, genuine.
Let's. Dear viewer, do not be fooled by this nonsense. There's nothing genuine about it.
This man
fully expects Kerry to beat Mayo at the weekend, despite what he's just said, and I'm happy to stand over that comment.
I think the massive price for Mayo this weekend, the massive price for Aidan O'Shea...
We're not addressing the question by getting involved in that discussion.
The question is, yes, Kerry have played more defensive football this year. It might not be the way they proceed, over the next couple of months. They are better at the back. That's why I got so annoyed about what Aidan O'Rourke had wrote for RTÉ the week before, because it was the one area where Kerry have made leaps and bounds this year. But the fact of the matter is, are they good enough to take down a fantastic Mayo side that are really roaring back into contention? I don't think so this weekend. Maybe later in the summer they will be, but... Actually probably doing an injustice to Mayo as well, who still have big players to come back in the likes of Killian O'Connor. So it's looking fantastic for Mayo when they bring that trophy west of the Shannon.
Can we just kill his mic? This is absolutely ridiculous propaganda that's coming from the Yarra jury. We will have more, I'm sure, from Owen on that very topic before we leave you this morning. That's us done with the newspapers for now. Up next, we're going to be talking to Daniel Harrison, Pledge Together, Teats took into there. But first of all, John Giles, as always, on a Thursday night, was with Nathan last night, and here he is talking about the appointment as the new permanent Manchester United manager of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
This is where the situation changes, Nathan. Say he buys 3 players, right? That means there's 3 players going to be left out. This is where it comes into management. Now, since he took over to Manchester United, there's been no windows, he hasn't got new players in, and he's done what he's done with the players that he's got at his disposal, and he's done very, very well. Now, in the summer, for example, say they buy 3 players, then somebody's not going to be happy. Then it becomes a different job of management altogether. You know, that's the thing in the game. And the fact that the players have proven that Mourinho was wrong, that'll be gone as well. So it'll be sort of a new job, a totally new job for Solskjaer when the next season starts. And it's a different test to the one that he's had done very, very well in, which is the initial test. So it's going to be, well, all managers every season, it's a different test every season, but it's particularly different for him because it's a new season, new players will be coming in. The players that are doing well for him now will be out of the squad, and they're not going to be too happy. All those things come into management. So that's it's going a new job for him and a new test for him next year. But he's doing well to get into position, and I think he's earned what he's been given so far.
That was John Giles on the show last night. You can check out that full piece on offtheball.com. Daniel Harris, football writer, good morning to you.
Good morning, hiya.
Daniel, any case to be made here that they'd let it roll this long, Manchester United, in terms of making the appointment, that they may as well have just let it roll to the end of the season, see does he finish top four and make the call then?
I think they probably had to make the appointment now on the basis that it was his job provided United don't collapse. So I think that if they want to sign players, they need to start preparing to sign those players now. And so if the only reason not to do it is there might be a collapse and they might have to get rid of him, I think it's fair that they say, well, they assume there's not going to be that collapse, and that enables them to sign players and be able to tell them who the manager is going to be. And so I think that it's also something that will lift everyone at the club for the next few weeks, rather than having the constant, is he going to be the manager, is he not? The players come into work now after the international break and after United have had a minor wobble, knowing that this guy that they like and they're enjoying working for, they're going to continue working for him. So I think it's fair enough that they've done it now.
Yeah, I often wonder if that's a factor that players, whether they give a toss about what manager is there or what's going to happen in the next season, Daniel. So you might just pick up on that point for us, if you could, just in relation to the players, whether they give a toss or not, and whether that's a factor in Manchester United's thinking when they make this appointment.
Yeah, I think that United would have thought about lots of things when making the appointment. The interesting thing about Ole is that, unlike any other manager who, more or less, who gets the job, he has justified his credentials for a particular job by doing that particular job. And no other manager can say that they've done that. So if you look at who the other candidates were, Pochettino, Allegri, they have credentials that they've proved in a different kind of way. But I think what we've seen since Fergie retired and since before Fergie is that managing United sometimes is different to managing other clubs. David Moyes was a good manager of Everton. He was someone who, personally, I thought was never suited for managing United. So he perhaps is an outlier. But if you look at Louis van Gaal and Mourinho, Louis van Gaal had just had an amazing World Cup. He'd done some amazing things in his career in football. So his life, his reputation in football was not contingent on what he did at United. But somehow he still seemed to freeze under pressure. Mourinho also, you felt like he'd been given the job of his life and he seemed determined not to appreciate it and to see it as a burden. And Solskjaer is not like that. He's a very different personality to those kind of people. And he understands football and he understands life in a very different way. And I think the way that he understands life, that life is something to be enjoyed, life is something to be experienced, life is something that's meant to make you happy, those are qualities that he shares with the people that have succeeded as manager of United. And so I think that you can make reasons as to why he shouldn't have got the United job. He hasn't got the experience. But actually, if you look at the things that he's done in the job, for me, the reasons why I think that he might fail are because it seems too good to be true, and things that seem too good to be true usually are too good to be true. And also because if most managers took this job, they would fail at it. When I look at the characteristics and the qualities that are specific to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, they all point towards him being quite a good fit for the job.
Yeah, and what he will have learned about life as well is it's all about being in the right place at the right time in a lot of these things, especially in football. And you were tweeting about that yesterday saying, imagine how Pep Guardiola's career would have gone had he taken, say, a job in Getafe. And, I mean, you can make the comparison between Solskjaer and Cardiff as well in that respect, that he did take the Getafe job in his career graph. Like, I do wonder, Daniel, are we still a little bit judging in our subconscious of what happens with Solskjaer at Cardiff City?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe some people are. I'm not, because I can see that jobs are very different. Alex Ferguson failed at St Mirren. That was a very different job to managing Manchester United. Solskjaer failed at Cardiff, but I mean, I was amazed he took that job in the first place, and I was amazed, even more amazed, that Fergie advised him to take it. Obviously, you can see why he did. It was a Premier League job. But what he did there will teach him what not to do. Like, don't try and impose a style on people, on players who aren't suited for that style. And I think we're seeing that at United. I'm sure he does not want to play in the way that United are playing at the moment, which is against teams who are rubbish. They're playing on the front foot. but against better teams, they're not able to dominate midfield, so they're playing on the counter. And this is what Louis van Gaal criticised him for in that big interview he did with BBC, where he said Solskjaer is just playing defensive football and winning results and getting results. I don't really think that's true. I think what he's doing is he's tailoring his team and his tactics according to what he knows the opposition can do. And so he is playing in a particular way at the moment in the big games. United tend to play, defend quite deep in the big games and look to play their football when there's space on the counter, because that suits the fact that United can't control midfield and they've got fast attacking players. And so that's very different to what he tried to do at Cardiff, where he turned up mid-season and tried to get a bunch of championship footballers mainly playing passing football. Like, that's not going to work. You're not going to achieve that in a short period of time. And I think what we've seen from Solskjaer in the last few months is that, is he really good at man management? Yeah, he's really good at that. He's really good at making people happy and getting the best of them. He's been pretty good tactically. I thought he fell down badly against Wolves, but otherwise his in-game changes have been excellent. His game plans have been excellent. So the only other element of management that we don't really know about yet is what is his eye for a player like? We could say he's done a pretty good job of that by picking the best players that he has at United so far, but when he has to actually buy players and get rid of players, that is a difficult thing to do, and he's probably not going to have a lot of margin for error, because he's going to maybe have money for between two and four players this summer, and he really needs to get almost all of them right. And as we know from looking at any manager, even the greatest managers, that very rarely happens. Like, a 50% hit rate on players that you buy as successful is pretty good.
And that kind of ties in with something that Van Gaal was also saying in that BBC interview, that Manchester United is a commercial club, not a footballing club. And I was just mentioning a few moments ago that Matt Dickinson in the Times this morning has taken that point on and says that it was a good day yesterday for the Glazers, simply in making United more appealing. But that is definitely not the same as putting the fear into the club's rivals at home and abroad. What do you think of that, Daniel?
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, no one is going to look at the appointment of Solskjaer, like United's rivals, and think, oh dear, what's he going to do? But people probably felt more fear about Mourinho and Van Gaal, and that didn't work. So I don't really think it matters very much, because whatever fear factor there is, it goes or develops according to what results are. And I would think that teams that are playing United now are more fearful than they have been pretty much at any time since Fergie left. And they will either be fearful or not fearful according to what United do under Solskjaer. So I don't really think it's about that. But the point about United being a commercial entity is a fair one. One of the reasons I'm sure that the Glazers were pleased to appoint Ole is that he was cheap. And if United had to try and get Pochettino out of Spurs, that would not have been cheap. And I wonder whether the money that they've saved on Pochettino will be put back into the team. Because really, the Glazers want to finish in the top four every season, because that enables them to take a maximum amount of money out. If they put any more money in trying to win the league, then there's not that much more money to be put in. And plus, you could put all the money in the world into United, and you might still not get more points than Manchester City. Who knows? Like, trying to win the league is always going to be a punt, but you can do quite a lot to make sure that you finish in the top four. And that's what they want to do. So I definitely wouldn't trust the Glazers to bankroll United according to what United need to be bankrolled, according to how City are bankrolled, and just according to what United's money is, like how much money there should be available to put into the club. But there are some really good players in the club already. There are some really good young players. I would say if they bought the right two players, then United would have a good chance of challenging for the title next season. If they bought three or four players and they were right, then I'd have a bet on them, I guess. I mean, I might have a bet on them anyway because I'm an idiot. But I don't think they're as far away as people think if they get the right players in next. But we don't know if Solskjaer is good at picking those players, never mind if those players are available or if the money for them is available.
Well, that's sort of the one point that I want to pick up on. Like, United have obviously demonstrated they can and generally do invest quite a lot of money in the transfer window. But the Cardiff City example, look, I don't know. I think a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here in terms of what happens with Solskjaer next season, like, we don't know. There's a whole bunch of variables that will suddenly come into play that haven't been necessarily in play now in terms of the pressure that comes, the added pressure, I think, that comes with being the permanent manager, and whether he's got an eye for a player or not. Like, the evidence of Cardiff City was, I think he bought about 17 players when he was there. I appreciate he's dealing with a totally different scouting network. You're looking for a different type of player. There's far less of a budget obviously involved there as well. There was a lot of players that just didn't do it for him. Some of those players that would have come in, Adam Lafondre, Juan Cala, Joan Gerberga, Makeda, flops generally. I mean, I know there was a couple of exceptions to that. What I'm trying to ask is what the evidence of Solskjaer having an eye for a player, or whether that matters at a club like Manchester United, because he's not going to be making these decisions on his own, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously going to have help with people recommending players, and also at some level, in a way, the players that Man United sign, you or I could pick. So when Alex Ferguson signed Wayne Rooney or Rio Ferdinand, those were great purchases, but they didn't require any skill whatsoever. It's in what you do once you've got them that is skillful. So if Solskjaer says, well, if he looks and he's got £100 million to go and spend on Jadon Sancho, let's say, we know that Jadon Sancho's a really good player. There is no skill in doing that. So because when you're shopping at the top end of the market, it's not just about skill. It's like the skill is always in building the team around it, and also in whether you can find a £40 million player who turns out to, in fact, be a £100 million player. So I think that with Solskjaer, what we do know is that he knows what a good player is because he was one and he played with them. At Cardiff, he wasn't buying that level of player. He was punting. Whereas at United, he knows what a midfield player is supposed to look like. So, because he played with Roy Keane, he played with Paul Scholes, he played with Michael Carrick. He has Michael Carrick available to him also. So I think that the judge of the player is going to be, as much as judging what a good player is, it's going to be buying the right player to integrate into the team that he has also. And we don't particularly know about that, but I think that when you're shopping at the top end of the market sometimes, you can just buy players that you know at least are going to be good because that everyone knows who the best players are. Mm.
He's going to get a bit of, it was a point that you lads touched on during the week as well, he's going to get a bit more leeway here than your average run of the mill. You mentioned some of them a bit earlier on. He is going to, I mean, I don't know if United end up finishing outside the top four this season, maybe this this outlook generally changes. But I do feel, obviously, given the legacy that he has with the club and the start that he's had, I suppose, he's going to get a bit more leeway from the fans here.
Possibly. I mean, I think that he won't get disrespected. But then most of the other post-Ferguson managers have also been given a fair amount of leeway. People were behind David Moyes from the beginning, even though it seemed to me to be a ludicrous appointment. Van Gaal got 2 seasons. He got probably 6 months more at least than he should have done. And Mourinho also got a fair amount of time. And I don't think that anyone could say that those guys were fired early. Mourinho, I felt, also probably got a bit longer than he should have done. So I think that the reasons why those managers got sacked wasn't because the fans turned on them, although people did turn on Moyes. People had enough of Van Gaal and they had enough of Mourinho. In the main, there wasn't an enormous fuss from the supporters at matches about those managers. There was bits and pieces, but not what you saw, say, at Liverpool when they had Roy Hodgson, which was what got them rid of Roy Hodgson and proved to be a very smart move on behalf of Liverpool support. They got Roy Hodgson fired much quicker than he would have been fired otherwise, and Liverpool needed that at the time. So Solskjaer will get leeway because people like him, but he'll also get leeway because he's manager of United and people know that it's a hard job. Like, people waited several years for Fergie to get it right, and it's not easy to do, particularly when you're chasing a club that is bankrolled by a country. So as long as there's that illusion of hope, and I think that's when the other managers got fired, when people had lost hope that it was going to work out. So as long as that notion of hope is there, that the club is improving, that you feel that they're going somewhere and they're going in the right direction, especially if they're playing decent football and they're playing young players, then there will be leeway and there will be tolerance because people understand that it's difficult.
Yeah. A couple of things we want to get your thoughts on, Daniel, the darts in a moment. But Liverpool Spurs, obviously, the weekend. The international break has sort of left us all with a great thirst, particularly this side of the water, to get back. Looking at some of this, the title race, obviously, this weekend and how all that stacks up. Liverpool Spurs have hit the skids a little bit over the last while. How do you see this one going at the weekend?
I mean, it's hard to know when you come back after the break. Liverpool had just hit their stride again, and now they wouldn't have appreciated that interruption, whereas Spurs probably quite liked it because it meant that Harry Kane could go away and get himself a goal. Dele Alli has a couple more games, so now he's a bit fitter. I think that I don't think Spurs will win at Anfield. I wouldn't be surprised if they got something out of the game, though, because if Liverpool don't get ahead early with City playing Fulham, they will start to feel some pressure. And pressure against a good team like Tottenham is not something you want to enjoy. So I think I would go for a score draw there. I think that Harry Kane is fitter and more confident. And Spurs know that they need to get something out of that game because they'll be under. If they get beaten, Spurs will be under big pressure, and then they're moving to their new ground. And who knows how things are going to work out? It just seems unlikely that they're going to go there, feel at home right away, and reel off a succession of momentous wins, because it often doesn't happen that way. And teams they're playing will want to ruin it for them. Will be inspired. So I would go for a score draw there. That's what I think will happen.
Okay, that's Liverpool Spurs this weekend. You have been tweeting about the retirement of Raben van Barneveld, one of the most successful darts players, obviously, of all time. He was involved from having watched a entrance video yesterday, I think it was, which was pretty emotional and pretty bloody unbelievable as well in the context of any sporting event in Rotterdam, I believe, and he's must have been beaten and is now retired.
I don't think I'd be entirely surprised if he unretired himself. But what is amazing about Raymond van Barneveld is the depth of his competitive spirit. I mean, obviously, he's a brilliant dart player. That's just obvious. But the thing that's kept him going this long is the love of competition and the ability to raise his game at crucial moments. So Raymond van Barneveld was never really a scoring machine in the way that Phil Taylor was, that Michael van Gerwen is. What Raymond van Barneveld was brilliant at was where he's thrown two singles, finding a treble with that last dart, with one dart in a set of three, and hitting those mid-ranking finishes. So two and three dart combinations of 70-something or 120, like that kind of thing. And that is about the love of competing and the ability to stay calm under intense pressure. And the fact that he's been doing it until this point tells you how much he loves competing and how difficult it's been for him to tear himself away. And if anyone's got a spare hour today, it's on YouTube. If you find yourself Raymond van Barneveld against Michael van Gerwen from the 2016 World Darts Championship, I would say that is some of the best live sport I've ever seen. And I've been to four European Cup finals, and it is up there with all those things. I saw one of the funniest things I've ever seen in sport, actually, was when Barney beat Michael. The crowd went absolutely wild, like the glasses were flying, the beer was flying everywhere. And I was standing in the press section, which was next to the corporate section. So various of the corporates flattened themselves against the wall that was underneath the cheap seats to avoid getting hit by beer. So people in the cheap seats leant over the wall and literally poured pint pots over the heads of the corporates, which was a lovely moment.
Any notable names in the corporate section?
No one I recognised, but I think it was just people with blazers and shirts and brown shoes. So the kind of people who no one should mind had beer for those of their heads.
It's not a good combination. Daniel, thanks a million as always. Cheers.
See you again, guys.
Daniel Harris, and that video is in fact on Daniel Harris's Twitter feed, so go and check that out, and you can shortcut to having to Google any of that stuff. The entrance that I watched, I don't know if you saw that yesterday, it was doing the rounds. Barney, before he went into his semi-final in Rotterdam during the week, the Eye of the Tiger comes on. It was like all this sort of klaxons ringing out just before he makes his entrance, and the crowd are going wild. And it looks to be like 100,000 people in this arena. I'm sure it wasn't that number, but it looked like an unbelievable crowd that were there. And he was emotional, obviously, because he knew he was coming towards the end, and he seemed to be hugging his mother at one point and various people on the way up and getting a bit emotional about the whole thing. It wouldn't be a crazy darts fan, but you could definitely get behind something like that. It was class.
Yeah, one of the good guys, really. Certainly more personable than Michael van Gerwen, and far more personable, far more likeable than Phil Taylor. Yeah. So it's actually kind of one of those genuine sort of well wishes, sad to see him go sort of moments.
Tyke Hegarty is wondering if shouldn't every Friday include me grilling you on your weekend plans?
Yeah. I'm sure it's going to happen at some point.
I mean, it does. Every Friday does. That's exactly what happens.
I'm just thankful that Kerry are playing this weekend. You can't grieve too much. I've got something to talk about.
What's going to happen the following weekend? Who knows?
She's not going to come in next Friday.
I have to live vicariously through somebody who's alive. That's...
What do you think about your weekend?
You understand that's what's happening.
Are you going drinking pints at the Leinster game tomorrow?
I will be... Sounds like a pretty good life. A couple of pints at some point or other. I didn't make much of an effort to get tickets, but I don't have tickets for the game.
Right. So I'm sure you'll get sorted eventually.
I mean, it's only 24 hours out now, so.
You followed them all season. You were there last year when they put down the greatest achievement in the history of sport, as you tweeted emotionally.
I think that was 2 years ago now. Was it not two years ago?
No, it was last year.
Are you sure? The Pro 14 semi-final, was it?
I think it was when they won the Pro 14, so it would have been after.
It's the final then?
Yeah, so it would have been.
At the Aviva.
Yeah. It would have been, they'd done the double last year, so.
You've misrepresented my point, obviously, but I'm entertaining you.
Greatest sporting achievement of all time.
Bullshit.
Your tweet proceeded to say, forget Michael Jordan winning six titles in the 90s, forget Tom Brady's Patriots. Forget the Kerry four in a row.
This double,
the Pro 14, the Heineken Champions Cup double, is the best.
We should have some sort of a Yarra button that just drowns you out when you get into the nonsense. Izzel Cody has been in touch to say that the Kerry folk read from a script. Owen is word for word my dad. Yarraism should be a medically recognised condition.
Yeah, it's a very serious condition.
It's a birthright, is what it is. It's not a condition, it's a birthright.
Yeah, you're born with it, you can't just learn it.
Right, Darren Cleary, for the very last time, is en route with your sports news for the morning, so that's coming away very shortly. Alan Quinlan as well is going to be along in about 5 or 6 minutes' time to preview the weekend's rugby, and we're going to get stuck into the performance of Seamus Coleman from the Ireland-Georgia game as well. That all coming your way before we leave you this morning. But before all of that, Pillar Caffrey had plenty to say on Off the Ball's new Gaelic football show about Dermot Connolly and why he thinks Dublin are dipping. You can watch the full thing back on offtheball.com. Here he is talking about Stephen Cluxton's role.
Cluxton, from, you know, my early days working with him, he used to always say to defenders and to management, my job is to stop savable shots. So, you know, put as much pressure as you can on the forward. Don't give him a one-on-one with me. You stay between him and the goal, and I will save 99% of them shots. Nowadays you don't get fellas having pot shots. Everybody tries to work the ball in so close to the goal. You're getting very few long range shots for goals anymore. So you know, goals are a lot of teams like are averaging one goal a game or less. So the kickouts have become such a huge part of it, and I think that's what we're judging on, this whole idea of keepers coming out and becoming free takers. I think, look, the long range free is obviously keepers, because they're taking so many kickouts and they're practicing for so many years, they have an advantage in terms of the length they can drive a ball. In terms of their accuracy, you know, I don't think their stats will stand up to a Dean Rock in terms of close in frees or whatever.
Yeah, that's Pillar Caffrey on the Gaelic Football Show. You can check out the full piece on offtheball.com. For the very last time, Darren Cleary, good morning to you.
Good morning, Adrian.
Here in my eye, if I was in any way in touch with my sort of emotions.
The only emotion you have on a Friday is anger and disdain towards Owen. I think that's the overriding.
I mean, maybe
emotion
disdain,
in the room.
But I think anger is a bit harsh.
I'm gonna miss you being the foil, Darren.
I just literally am in the middle and stopping you guys from hitting each other in between the breaks.
Who's going to be the voice of Dublin football to talk about process and all that in your absence?
Really, I'll spare you, because I don't think anyone needs to hear any more about the process. Let's face
it.
Are you getting out now
because you've seen what's happening with the league and you're just concerned that when the championship kicks off, things are going to go to shite and you're going to have to sit here sort of talking about the process and doing the Yarra stuff?
or maybe
no, it's the Dublin version of the Yarra where you decided what that was. What was that? Ajazing,
yeah.
I'm going to spare myself the ajazing. It is a coincidence that I'm leaving while Dublin are starting to decline.
I've heard that the word came from on high that you weren't doing a good enough job of doing Jesus, and you're going to be replaced with someone called Gim Javin.
No, the truth is there was actually no issues. There was nothing to see here. Everything is fine, and there is no reason other than that I've decided to. It's a big commitment, of course, and you give up your time for free, and I don't have time to give up for free anymore. Is that a good Jim Gavin line?
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Sounds quite like Jim Gavin.
You're a true Gael.
A true Gael, a great Gael.
Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Where are you after?
I'm going to go to the internet, the Web Summit.
Right.
Yeah.
The internet will never catch on, I understand.
I don't think so. But I look forward to crossing paths with Owen, because he was at the Web Summit last year and you went to see a Benfica game, half a Benfica game.
Was it half a game? What? Have you just been outed as having only got to see half a Benfica game?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Jesus, the last action he takes is to totally bust me, Owen.
The full game.
Elaborate, by all means.
The fact that the beer was 0.0% has absolutely nothing to do with any decision we took.
Enough of a window of time has passed that you can now.
It was that great Ajax team now that have gone on to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. We got to see them in the flesh, of course, knowing at the time that they were going to do their great things.
For 45 minutes. Wow.
And the other 45, yeah.
When did you figure out it was 0%? Because I had about four of them. Then someone was like, you know, that's kind of a waste of time and you're just drinking for the taste, which I wasn't. And I realised that I had been drinking 0% non-alcoholic beer because all of the grounds are dry.
All right.
Yeah, it's like very disrespectful to football fans, obviously, to do that. It took me, after I bought the round, I realised. And the beer smelled of beans as well.
Oh, Jesus.
Wasn't great.
On that note, Johnny Sexton is how you're going to kick things off for us, Darren.
Yes, he's emerged as a doubt, Adrian, for tomorrow's Champions Cup quarter-final between Leinster and Ulster. Leo Cullen looks set to start the fit again Ross Byrne if Sexton does not come through this morning's session. Okay, Byrne missed the last game. He was pulled on match night with what Leinster called a tight foot, but it's believed he has trained fully this week. Jack McGrath expected to be left out ahead of his impending move to Ulster, which could be announced in the next week. Ed Byrne will be on the bench with Keane Healy starting. Leo Cullen has been assessing the threat of the men from the north.
Ulster are very good at just taking their opportunities when they come along. So, yeah, no, I'd be impressed with them this year. And, yeah, no, we know a lot of their players very, very well. They will know us very well as well. So, yeah, it should be a great game. Yeah, no, bonus point win again at the weekend. You know, and yeah, as I said, they're very settled in their team. You know, they haven't chopped and changed a huge amount. We probably chop and change our team a little bit more. And this was the fact that they haven't had to chop and change their team as much means that they've good cohesion the way they're trying to play the game. So a number of their players obviously know us very well, which presents some other challenges for us. But, you know, they've gone well this year, Ulster, and we know it's going to be a great challenge for us.
Now, Ulster injury news.
Did you pick that photograph yourself?
Yeah.
Can we put Leo Cullen? Well, we probably can't without playing the. It was.
No,
you can scroll back.
There you go.
Oh, that's unfair.
It's just a picture of Leo Cullen.
That's pretty unfair, isn't it?
I didn't take it.
No, but you did choose it. I mean, that's it, Darren. Your last bullet never here. Go on.
I've ended on a corker. Wait till you see. Ian Henderson, Ulster's main injury concern, the influential lock, suffering a knee problem during Ireland's Six Nations win over France. He has been struggling to train fully this week, we understand. Joey Carberry set to return to the Munster starting 15 for their game against Edinburgh at Murrayfield. The out-half has been struggling with a hamstring injury but is believed to be fit. The provinces will name their teams this afternoon. Connacht kick off a massive weekend for European rugby. Tonight they take on the Sale Sharks in the Challenge Cup quarter-final in Manchester. Southampton manager Ralph Hasenhüttl says players need education, protection and treatment from video games. He has revealed that the club will be blocking Wi-Fi in hotels to stop players from spending too long on their games consoles. The Saints boss reckons video games are as addictive as alcohol or drugs. He says the issue deserves to be taken seriously.
I did it in my last club. We had also problems with players. They were playing until 3 o'clock in the morning in front of a game. It's not a small problem, I think, because if you be honest, then it's the same like alcoholism or getting addicted to drugs or something like that. It's something you get addicted to, and that means you have to protect the players. It's something we have to do as a club. To protect them means help them to not to spend so much time there. And as long as it's not officially for the government an illness, then we have to protect them in our way, yeah? Because if it would be an illness, that would be easy to say for the government. The companies have to give a block after 3 hours, for example, that they can't play this game anymore. And after 3 hours, if it's finished, and then it's 20 hours blocked, then we don't have to do this. Otherwise, you see, we block the Wi-Fi in the hotel, for example, in the evening, so that they can't play anymore.
Darryl O'Toole was in touch on YouTube to say it was the best photo of Leo Cullen that he's seen in ages. Kind of looks like Roald Dahl's The Big Friendly Giant. Get Leo back up again.
There's a lot of scrutiny of this Leo Cullen picture.
Not back to Leo.
No, Tommy's having none of it.
Fair enough.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer won't disrupt one of Liverpool's star players in the middle of their title chase. There were reports that Virgil van Dijk was set to be evicted by the new Manchester United manager. He's been living in his old house in Cheshire. Solskjaer says he will not be throwing the Liverpool defender out, mainly because they've a lease agreement in place that he will not be breaking. Here at home, Shamrock Rovers look to extend their lead at the top of the SSE or Tristy League later. Stephen Bradley's Chargers start tonight's game with UCD at Belfield with a 7-point lead. Dundalk in second face their bitter rivals Cork City. There's a Dublin derby at Dalyman Park. Bows look to get back to winning ways after a loss and two draws in their last four games. They face the St. Pat's side, who are winless in their last four games. Finn Harps continue their search for a first win of the season. They're away to Waterford. Elsewhere, Derry City go head-to-head with Sligo Rovers. Well, in golf, Rory McIlroy is on course for the last 16 of the WGC Match Play Championship in Texas. The Ulsterman recorded a 3-2 win against Justin Harding. If he avoids defeat in the final group game against Matt Fitzpatrick, McIlroy will advance to the final. Shane Lowry finished all square with Patrick Reed yesterday, but unfortunately the Offaly man is heading for an early exit. And my last story on my last day involves a burger that fell from space. Colchester United staff were left stumped after a burger fell from the sky and landed at their training ground. The mystery box was quickly solved when the box attached to the burger started to ring. When answered by a groundsman, he found a man named Tom on the other end of the line. Tom is a YouTuber who attached a McDonald's Big Mac burger to a weather balloon and sent it to space along with a GoPro to document the burger's journey. The balloon popped and the burger sailed safely back to Earth, where it landed on the training ground of the League Two club Colchester United in Essex. Tom found the burger, there you can see, and he ate it. He said it was frozen and tasted kind of powdery.
Wow.
Darren, I mean, in all the time you've been here, what a horseshit story to end on. What was the point?
What wasn't the point, Adrian? That was a great feat of science. One giant step for McDonald's, one giant leap for mankind and all that. I thoroughly enjoyed it there, and don't let the haters grind you down.
That's a good story to end on.
It's even, its relationship to sport is so loose.
A burger landed in a football training ground. I think that relationship is pretty earth-shattering and pretty intergalactic, to be honest with you.
I mean, if it's Beals in the bushes, you like that, but if it's a burger falling from space, you're not interested.
Right. We are going to miss you, Darren. We've enjoyed your company. Last couple of minutes with that shite story, but generally you've been excellent and a pleasure to deal with. We wish you the absolute best of luck in your new endeavours. Don't be a stranger.
I won't be a stranger.
Where are you going to be based?
I'll be based out in Dartry.
Oh, well, you will be a stranger then. Yes.
No, but when you're attacking the Dubs, I'll make sure I come in.
We'd love to hear from you again.
Storm
thanks a million.
Thank
pleasure
you
working with you. Thanks a lot.
It's been enjoyable. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Darren Cleary there. Alan Quinlan's going to be up next previewing the weekend's rugby. We did have a major outing at the Olympia during the week. It was the Heineken Rugby Club show in the Olympia. We had Michael Checker there, and he recalled what it was like during his time when he arrived at Leinster.
You've got to remember, you've got to look at everything with perspective, right? So you've got to think about where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
So I get here. I thought, man, these guys are good. Like, I saw them at training.
Jeez, this Brian O'Driscoll kid's good, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I thought, these guys are good. Like, they've got some ability. There's a few holes, like, you know, you've got to fill and build, build in, which is absolutely normal. But there's a lot of... the style of game that I like to play, there was a lot there to work with, you know what I mean? And so, we just had to start building it and building on top of maybe the flaws we did have and keep going and see what happened there.
And can you talk to us about how you did that or what that involved? Because the word culture is often talked about when we talk about you. You know, there's 10-year anniversary now, or we've often done shows where your name comes up, as you might imagine, and it's things like, well, check it, change the culture. That's one of the big lines. Can you talk to us about that from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, the players change the culture. You just set the direction. The players wanted to... Well, you heard what Shane just said there. Like, I didn't ever want to leave. I want to be here. This is where I want to be. And once you realise what you actually want, I think that's where I can help them and say, what do you really want out of this? Like, do you want to hold up the trophy? Do you want to have a team that people in your town and in your province support and will be behind? And do you want to live in that world, or do you just want to play footy and go home at the end of the day? I think you've got to guide people there, but then they've still got to take it and run with it. You can't force culture, whatever that is. It's not a real great word for it, because that comes from generations and generations and generations of, you know, a nation's DNA. But they built that amongst themselves from the lead that was given, and very much player driven. Once they just got a bit of direction as to what to do, because you don't know what you don't know.
Michael Checker there from the Olympia during the week. That full piece is up on offtheball.com, well worth your time. Alan Quinlan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Adrian.
You'd have been a Checker hater, I presume, given you.
No, I wasn't. No, I liked
carry over of career,
We had one clash in a dressing room tunnel after a Leinster-Munster game. I think it was around 2006 or 2007. He was screeching at the referee and I kind of intervened as well and told him shut up, and then he told me shut up, and then that was it. But we actually get on quite well together. And surprisingly enough.
What? So that was it? Shut up, you shut up, good luck.
Yeah, and a little bit of a few heated words. It was
like what?
That's all. I couldn't say, to be honest. It'd be too vulgar.
Well, give us the clean version.
Shut the F up. We both kind of repeated that a few times and it was a bit of pointing fingers and stuff. It was nothing. It happened really quickly. No. We were a good bit away. I think he was just screeching at the referee about decisions that were going against Leinster in the first half. So
that wouldn't be something you'd do.
No, I always left the referees alone. I liked him. In fairness, you know, I went to Australia last year with Sky for the tour, and he met me for an interview and stuff. And I actually sent it back here for News Talk. It wasn't for Sky, and you know, he went out of his way to facilitate that and meet me in a coffee shop. And you know, he's honest. He wears his heart in his sleeve, and he has that bit of fire in him. So
he'd have been a good fit for Munster at some point along the line, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would, of course. He'd be, you know, if you buy into. To be fair, what he did with Leinster was brilliant, and he had a ruthless approach. You know, not everybody liked it, and people who maybe got pushed aside didn't like him. But he's abrasive and. Very passionate about what he's trying to do. So if you get people buying into that and you get good players around it, he had that success, you know. He tried it instead. The French rugby is, you know, it can go anyway. And getting Australia to World Cup final in 15. And he's had his ups and downs with Australia, particularly in the last year. You know, there's been a lot of questions and a lot of turmoil, player personnel, all that kind of stuff going on there. But He certainly brought great success to Leinster, didn't he, and turned them around.
Munster weekend, obviously, in the Heineken Champions Cup, so that's why we want to talk to you. The Joey Carberry news, obviously, was the first thing to get into ahead of the Edinburgh Munster game at the weekend, 12:45 tomorrow at Murrayfield. And before we get into the ins and outs of the game, Joey Carberry has extended his loan deal.
Yeah, it's massive. I think it's caught me by surprise. I didn't know that he was looking to extend so quickly, because he's not, obviously hasn't the first year completed, but he's obviously happy there and he wants to stay there. And I think Munster were, you know, it's a real coup to get him to extend now. I think the thought process when he left Leinster was that maybe he'll do 2 years in Munster and come back to Leinster and Johnny Sexton retires and all that kind of stuff, but that's not happening now, and he's obviously thrown his lot in. And I think it's easy for me to say as a former Munster player, but I think if you go down there, you've got to really ingrain yourself in the culture and the jersey and the people and the passion of rugby in Limerick and in Munster, all over Munster, the way it's grown. And obviously he's done that, and he's made a statement to say, I'm here to stay for another couple of years anyway.
Rog is writing about him in the Irish Examiner this morning, and he's guessing that privately the Leinster management last year when he left to go to Munster would have been seething, that he had to leave.
Of course they would, and they would have every right to be seething. If I was one of the Leinster coaches, I'd be saying, well, we put all the time and work and brought this guy from Clontarf from and brought him into the academy and the group and gave him the opportunities. But like I've said this many times, that's just the nature of the way it's gone on. It's the IRFU and look, maybe Jack McGrath moved to Ulster, and there's a lot of player movement, something that's happening more regularly now.
But he clearly loves it down there if he signed up.
That was a big one, you know. He was a big, big name who was starting for Leinster, you know, played a lot of games, starting at full back at times when Rob Kearney was gone, coming off the bench, a real contributor to that Leinster team, and an Irish international. So that was a hammer blow to them, because, you know, he would have been seen as the long-term successor, even though Ross Byrne was there as well. But they wouldn't have been pleased with that. But it's a massive boost to Munster to keep him. And he obviously likes it there, you know.
The exciting thing almost, I think, about Carberry is that we haven't seen the best of him yet, I don't think. I think there's a lot of growth yet.
No, of course, yeah. I think he's going to get stronger and have more of a presence. And he has great natural skill and ability and evasiveness. And any 10 can always keep working on game management, no matter what level you're at. You know, the best 10s in the world can have an off day with the boot and their tactical kicking and stuff. So they have to continuously keep working on that. And so yeah, you'd imagine he's only going to get better. And I think he's a real good attitude, Adrian, as well. He's a lovely, calm demeanour, and yeah. I think he wants to keep learning. But he has a confidence as well, which is not a cockiness. And I think bar the cast away game, he's been superb this year for Munster. And I love the way he bounced back from that disappointment of not just him, the whole team, but, you know, when you're a fly half and he missed a couple of kicks in that game, and then he went on an incredible run of slotting everything. It's a real good sign of the character as well.
So he looks as if he's back fit this weekend and he's good to go by all accounts. Is that the...
It's massive for Munster. He's obviously, it's tricky when he's going to be undercooked because he hasn't played in over a month. And
does it help Murray, like, in terms of the baggage, right, that I suppose a lot of these Irish players are going to be dealing with post Six Nations, if such a thing exists, and you assume that it is hard to shake off
exist,
a couple of months?
Yeah, it does exist, and the worst thing can happen for any of the Irish players now is that something goes wrong early in one of the games tomorrow for them, like they drop a ball or miss a tackle or something, and that will add a little bit more doubt. And
does it help with Murray in that instance that there's a freshness with, he wouldn't have played with Carberry obviously over the last couple of months, because of the injury and that sort of thing. Does it help that there's a freshness then, and it makes it easier to say, well, look at that?
Well, you have a real confident top quality international player outside you, and you know, of course that helps. With respect to JJ Hanrahan and Tyler Blaindell, they're not at the level of Joey Carberry, and that's just a fact. So he's bringing real quality there. Now, you know, he pulled out of the Cass game in Limerick, was it? And JJ came in and played really well, and he had a super game. But to have Carberry there, and the familiarity of working together, not just with Munster, but with Ireland for the last two seasons as well. So, yeah, that'll be massive for him. And the thing about your fly half is you want him to be dominant and vocal and stuff, and that's something Joey Carberry will get better at, because you've got to run a back line, make a lot of decisions. So he'll be vital in that front tomorrow. And the last time he was in Murrayfield, you know, he made a brilliant break and gave Earls the pass for the try for Ireland, you know. So it's vital that he's back, and he's a massive boost to Ireland, or to Munster.
How worried are you?
Very worried, because I just see this as a real... Saying it's a banana skin is not fair in Edinburgh, because I think they're a very good side, and, you know, you always get the coaches speak or players speak saying, well, the opposition are good and they're this and they're that. I just have a real nervousness about this one, because based on Edinburgh's performances this year, I wrote the results down there, but they won away in Toulon.
In the Champions Cup particularly, been excellent.
Yeah, well, look, they've so many Scottish internationals now in November, and Six Nations are going to be affected because all those guys are away. But, you know, they should have beaten Montpellier in round one. They lost by 6 points in Montpellier. They beat Toulon 40-14 in round two. They won at home to Newcastle and then away to Newcastle. Now you could say Newcastle are down the table in the Aviva Premiership, but to win away in Europe is big. And then a 28-17 win in Toulon, even though, you know, you can argue Toulon and Newcastle have been struggling in their respective leagues, but to win away like that in Europe, you take a bit of attention. And
like,
then,
does it suggest a bit of, like, they're a bit of a cup team, like, because they're not exactly performing to the same level in the Pro 14?
Yeah, they're learning now to cope with both, if you like, because they're not usually in knockout stages of Europe. They have been on a few occasions for sure, but I think that's what Richard Cockerell wants to do. He wants to, and he's extended his squad. If you look at their back row, there's five internationals that I can name. And that's aside from guys who, you know, are up and coming and have come through their academy and stuff. Magnus Bradbury, Bill Matha, John Barkley, Hamish Watson, Jamie Ritchie. He's 5-3 there, which is, who does he choose? Does he go for the 2-7s and go after Munster's breakdown? Or does he pick Bradbury at 6 and Ritchie at 7? Two big guys with Bill Matha. Matha will start. So when you list off their players, WP Nell, Stuart McInally, Alan Dell, they're all they're Scottish front row. Simon Bergen is another tight end. They have Ben Toulis, Grant Gilchrist. They're Scottish internationals. The whole pack is practically the Scottish pack. And so Watson has said this week that Munster should expect a real battle up front, and that's where it's going to be won or lost. And then they've recruited very well. Van der Merwe is a superb player in the back line. King Horn. And Darcy Graham is someone who's, he's a bit like Jordan Larmour, and he started the last couple of games for Scotland. Unbelievable footwork. So they have a list of really, really good players. And because it's Edinburgh, you think, well, you shouldn't be as nervous and as worried as normal if you're going to the south of France, or if you're going to, you know, to Saracens away or something like that. But
the stakes are big. Like, I mean, if Munster get beaten, the season's a write-off.
Yeah, it is. The only way you could salvage it is by winning the Pro 14, which is, you know, small consolation, I think. You want the players themselves have been in the last two semi-finals, and they're trying to close that gap. They're trying to get their hands and really be at the top table in Europe. And getting into the last four in the last 2 years has been really good achievement. But you got to say it's a better Munster team this year. Tyburn coming into the squad has been sensational from Carberry. Two top quality internationals.
Where's the Munster weakness if you're Edinburgh?
Chris Farrell. The Munster weakness, I think is taking their opportunities and having a bit of variety in their game. They have, you know, when Chris Farrell has played for him, he gives them a lot of options in that 13 channel of offloading. I think with Earls, Conway, they have a lot of pace. They have a lot of danger.
You're giving me all the strengths now.
Yeah, I know. Weaknesses is taking opportunities. They've stuttered. I think the performance away in Gloucester was one that went, that's what you want to see. They won 41-15 in Gloucester, and that was very, very impressive. It's a very tough place to go to King's Home. And then some parts of me thinks you go to Cast and you think of that performance where they were very inaccurate in what they were trying to do. And there wasn't a lot of variety to their carries.
There was also the question, and we were talking about this, the kind of the tough nature of that game. And just to cite O'Gara as well this morning, he picks your name out. He says, Leamy, Foley, Quinney, Pauly. I knew they'd knock the heads off someone, do whatever it took to get a result when the chips were down. Like, is that, has that been missing at certain
times?
Well,
that was missing maybe in Cast a little bit, where physically they just needed to dominate a little bit more. Look, the game has changed. You can't knock the head off anyone anymore. You can't, like, I know what he's trying to say, that it's about physical presence. But we'd been around for a long time before that. They're trying to get their own kind of brutality, if you like, up front. You want your pack to be aggressive and intimidating and dominant. And, you know, they'd admitted themselves they were frustrated and pushed around a little bit in Cast. They still should have won the game. Flip side of that, as a unit, they went to King's Home and they fronted up. The front row were superb. They were aggressive. They were in the opposition's face. Their carries, their efficiency to break down. If you remember that game, Stander runs out over someone, knocks him back, pumps the legs for 10 yards. That's the kind of stuff you want. Jean Klein, a few great carries, a couple of turnovers. Big things, moments like that. That's what you want from your pack. And that's what they got to do tomorrow, because Edinburgh really fancy their chances here. So if one opportunity here, when I say what's their weakness, is probably taking their opportunities when they create something, if somebody makes a line break, and just being more accurate. They were very good at it in Gloucester, but probably not consistent enough throughout the pool stages. There's a lot of resilience in this side now, to be fair. They went to Exeter in round one, and that was a great performance to get a draw. They should have won that game. But then you go right on to round six, and you think, the inaccuracies there, they won 9-7, you know, so that's a little bit of concern. But they're growing, and there's a lot of, the team is unsettled all year with the nature of the season, and they've got to try and put it all together very quickly, Johan van Gran, as of Edinburgh, because their internationals were away as well. They probably played more of them last week than Munster did, so
call it first.
Switch it on. A draw.
It can't be a draw. If you're saying a draw, you're leaning to Edinburgh.
I can't go against Munster, but I'm nervous. I think Munster might just They've got to play well.
You
really
think Edinburgh
well.
Are going to win? I can tell by you.
Well, you can say I'm going to say Munster, but you can think what you want.
I'm reading between the lines.
I'll put it this way, and simple. I wouldn't be surprised if Edinburgh beat them.
Yeah.
But I think Munster will. They'll be very cautious themselves, and they know that, and that sometimes can ignite you. So, Carberry's massive. He's a huge swing in Munster, maybe just nudging it. The bookies are saying 4 points to Munster.
Yeah.
Will they be intimidated going to Scotland? No. A lot of the players play there regularly. But if they've got to impose themselves and be accurate and cut out the mistakes.
They're saying 15 points for Leinster. Can you see them hockeying Ulster?
Yeah, look.
They're not going to hockey them, are they? 15 points seems extremely generous.
Ulster are going to take a lot of from what they did in the pool stages, to be fair. And given where they have been the last number of years, it's a really good achievement. That's where you want to go. At least be getting to knockout stages of Europe. We always looked at that and said, there's no negotiation around this. It has to be knockout stage. And then you have that kind of feel-good factor. Okay, you can lose a knockout, a quarter-final. I think it only happened. We lost in Scarlets in 2007. And it's very disappointing for sure. But I think for Ulster, on their development and what they're trying to create, it's a really good achievement. Now, if they go there with that attitude, it's probably not going to help them. They're in bonus territory, but they've got to produce a really good performance and hope Leinster underperform. And I think even an underperformance from Leinster still has them winning the game by, you know, 7 to 10 points.
Sexton being out surely reduces that spread.
It does, yeah. I think, Ross Byrne has been a very able deputy, hasn't he? Anytime he stepped in, he's improved so much. I'm a fan of his. I think he's a real good player. And Leinster have a number of injuries. You know, Van der Fleer missing, Robbie Henshaw. But they've coped. They were brilliant against. They started this competition, and people were comparing them to the All Blacks and saying that nobody could stop them when they beat Wasps 52-3 in round one. Then they lost against Toulouse and showed a little bit of vulnerability. For Ulster to have any chance of beating Leinster, this sounds quite simplistic. They've got to hold on to the ball for long periods and stop. Leinster do that so well that they just wear you down with their intensity and their pace and the way they just, you know, the speed at which they clean out breakdowns and stuff like that. And you're hanging on for 5 or 6 phases, and then it's someone makes a line break and or gives away a penalty, and they just build momentum and build a scoreline all the time. So Leinster have got to control it. And it's interesting about, you know, if Sexton doesn't play, on the flip side, the Ulster fly half, Billy Burns, where he plays, puts the ball for his team. He's kicking game. They've troubles at the centre. Will Addison is, they've a lot of injuries there with their centres. Marshall might be back, Luke Marshall. We don't know the teams yet, obviously, till later on today. But I think Will Addison's a massive loss to him. He's been superb this year, and he gives him a real creativity about them. And, you know, you want to try and get the ball to Stockdale and get him one-on-one with people and hope that you can get a bit of width in the game. Ian Henderson is vital as well to him up front. And Will Jordy Murphy.
Second row, but there's so much interest, intrigue, isn't there, almost? Like the second
there
row.
There is, yeah, yeah. But hookers. I just don't think Ulster have enough of top quality players right across the board. They have a lot of really, really good players who are, you know, this is new territory, new ground for them. Jordy Murphy will have helped, you know, the psychology and the confidence and the self-belief, because he's been with Leinster for so long. He won a European Cup with them last year, and now he's gone up against his old team. So maybe he'll give him some insights about that detail. But it's not rocket science. They've got to front up and be physical. Leinster just impose themselves so well on the opposition, and when they get that flow and momentum, they're very hard to stop.
You're going Leinster?
Yeah, I'm going Leinster, yeah.
So Edinburgh, Leinster, and in the Sale Connacht game.
You're going with Edinburgh, I'm
going
Munster.
In the Sale Connacht game. That's like they've won each, obviously, in the mid, know each other at the pool stages. And
Sale look very strong, to be fair. I think it's going to be tricky for Connacht. The way they've played all season, you think that they will throw caution to the wind. But the problem was in the pool stages when Sale beat him 34-13 or something like that, was it? I wrote it down there somewhere. Yeah, 34-13 in the pool stages was...
October,
they were very porous defensively, so they've got to be really, really strong. I think they'll score and... Connacht have a confidence the way they play under Andy Friend to score, but it's a strong sales side, so unfortunately I think they may come up short, but they're a side that play with so much kind of belief and they're expansive that if they start the game well, they could get a result.
Sale, Leinster and Edinburgh is the clean... That's
what you're saying, yeah.
That's a big blow for your boys, isn't it, getting beaten by Sale tonight, Adrian?
Crusaders beaten this morning. We were sort of looking to book Ron in for a slot this morning. He was...
Yeah, they won 32-8 and they bounced back from losing against the Waratahs last week, so he'll be pretty pleased.
Good stuff. Quinny, pleasure as always. Thanks a million for that. We'll catch up with you next week. Yeah, thanks a lot. Alan Quinnell there as always on a Friday, giving his thoughts ahead of Monster Weekend in Champions Cup, Heineken Champions Cup rugby. So that's we're going to leave that for the minute. We're going to be talking Seamus Coleman. That's coming your way in just a few minutes' time. Nathan Murphy is, I think, is he on the line? Tommy, is that what we're saying? There he is.
How are we?
Nathan Murphy.
Good morning.
You're up and at them.
Why not? You making some outrageous comments earlier, so I thought I'd come on and just provide a little bit of balance.
What was this about Connacht?
What's your problem with Connacht?
No.
Are you not from Connacht?
Ah, Jesus, another one for the list of the nonsense list. Right, so
you turned your back on the people of Connacht. Mal O'Kelly's your hero, even though you were born in Connacht.
No. Let's not even get into it.
Mal O'Kelly, your hero.
Big Mal is one of my all-time heroes, yeah.
Well, for how long? Since you've been 30?
Genuinely, yeah. What are you sneering about? He's like one of the greatest, one of the most capped Irish players of all time.
Oh, he is. We should all have heroes, no matter how old
they are. Yeah. That's right. I don't know what's wrong with that. We've gone down a rabbit hole here, which I suspect we may be doing with our next topic as well. Just want to sort of give people a bit of context here. Obviously, the Ireland-Georgia game during the week, and conversation came up around the office about the performance of Seamus Coleman, good, bad, or different. And I certainly, my initial instinct, having been at the game, was that he had a bit of a stinker, and the great football minds of the off-the-ball department, yourself included, rubbished this fact and said that actually, I mean, in your words, later in the week, it was one of his top 10 all-time performances in an Ireland shirt. Do you stand by that nonsense?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think, now, Seamus Coleman has probably struggled to replicate his best Everton form when he's been in a green jersey, but I thought he was very strong on Tuesday night, constantly provided an outlet up the right-hand side, was calm when he got the ball. Obviously, the defence was very solid over the two games, and I think he did very, very little wrong. I was shocked when you came in.
Okay, let's press pause on that conversation right there. He did very little wrong. So I've watched this entire game back, as I've been mentioning a little bit earlier in the show, and for the purposes of research, and looking specifically at Seamus Coleman. So the parameters of the bit of research were that I was not looking at any of the other players, and I wasn't looking at the overall Ireland performance necessarily. It was really just to review on the basis of you saying this was the top 10 Seamus Coleman performance of all time. And so that was really the parameters of the conversation. So I had a look at it, and I went through every single involvement that Seamus Coleman had over the course of the game. There were 49 of them, to my reckoning. 19 of them were positive involvements. 18 of them were negative involvements. And
what bullshit statistics are these? What constitutes a negative involvement?
Do you mind if I actually get into it? Now that I've bothered to actually review the game, if it's okay, I might actually just get into some of that. 19 positive, negative involvements, 18 positive and 12 that were neither one nor the other. I'd have to accept that obviously this was my review, so I decided whether it was positive or negative. I went into a pretty open and a pretty open mind. Overall, he didn't play as bad, I would have to admit, as I thought he had done. We were discussing earlier on what his overall mark, I was giving him out of 10, and I'm probably giving him about a 4.5. In hindsight, I was kind of thinking maybe about a 3 post-game.
What?
So I'm weighing in with about a 4.5. Played decent in patches, played okay, about good 7 or 8 minutes maybe just before half-time. Couple of decent 1-2s. Didn't have a lot to do defensively, obviously, because they were playing 2 Bob Rovers, who, to be fair, were brutal on the night. No ambition, no capacity to string any great attacks together. Georgia were just awful. So didn't have a huge amount to do defensively, but clearly not the Seamus Coleman that we were once used to looking at, that we spoke about. There was an ongoing conversation about when Seamus Coleman was joined Manchester United. He's definitely not that player now. He has no pace. He is very poor on the ball at times. He doesn't start to play from the keeper. There wasn't one time over the course of the game, and I'm going to give you some specific examples now in just a moment, but there wasn't one occasion in the game where Darren Randolph rolled or kicked the ball out to his right back. Not once at any point during the game. Those moves, when they were started across the defence, were coming through Shane Duffy and Enda Stevens. So whether that's a confidence in Seamus Coleman or a circumstance, I would offer the idea that not once did it happen is more than just a coincidence. Can't beat his man in any way as much as he used to be able to do. Can't get across in like he once did. And I guess the question at this point, you have to beg the question as to whether Matt Doherty would be a better option in that position. On the basis of, I've picked out five samples that I'm going to try and best demonstrate to back up the argument that I'm making here. These all fall within the 19 negative impacts that Seamus Coleman had during the game. So these are just facts, right? These are not sort of any kind of opinion one way or the other. These are just facts of things that you say. This was Seamus Coleman, one of his top 10 performances of all time. This is what happens over the course of a top 10 performance. First, we're going to have a look at here, Tommy, is the this is maybe his first touch in the game. That's Seamus Coleman, that's circled there. And he's obviously got a huge amount. This is the perfect opportunity from where Ireland could potentially launch an attack. Look at all that space that's ahead of him. That's Robbie Brady, who's just about to run in off the shoulder there into miles of space. He overkicks the pass to such an extent that it rolls out over the end line. Like, that was his first involvement in the game. Absolutely abysmal. Perfect opportunity for Ireland to set up an attack. That should be Seamus Coleman's bread and butter. Overcooks the pass. Ball goes out. Goal kick. That's the first instance I want to look at. Next instance I want to look at is a few minutes later, really. To be fair, he makes a great run into the box here. You can see Jeff Hendrick is just about to slide the ball into the area. He's done excellently to get into that position, which, to be fair, he did right through the course of the game. Got into excellent positions at times where the ball may have fallen to him from a deflection or from a pass that it just really never did. But this is one of the times where it did. Takes a brilliant opportunity to get into the box. Holds the line brilliantly. Gets to the end line to get the ball away. You can see Seamus Coleman circling at the top of the box there, and you can see the ball, and 17 is... Harran is clearly looking over at Seamus Coleman saying, what the hell have you just done? That ball is... You can't tell from the trajectory of it there, but is two Shane Duffys wouldn't have got the head on that ball, and it's gone out over the left-hand touchline and out of play for a throw-in. Third instance I want to look at is just about half an hour into the game. Again, takes up a really good position. Pretty much a carbon copy of the first instance that we looked at. And again, pretty much the exact same setup. Takes the ball right wide out on the right-hand side. Robbie Brady is making the run in. Oceans of space ahead of him. So everything brilliant up to that. And he can't get it past that Georgian defender that you can see that's just about to get into him there. Takes a throw in. Ball hits the Georgian defender. Ball goes out for a throw. So, they're the first three. See, if you're doing that, you're not paying attention to the facts,
sorry,
right?
But sorry.
That's wow, that's fine. That's your there. That's you got to do a bit of lazy punditry. That's for, wow, that's for you to get into. 2 minutes into added time at the end of the first half. Fourth instance, wow, here. Coleman, this is some of his defensive duties. You can see him circle there with the Georgian defender. Up to that point, he'd been covering quite well. Georgia looking to play a ball over the top. That's Coleman's man just on his left-hand shoulder. And the yellow circle is Coleman's man now. He's lost him entirely. He has to palm him off to Shane Duffy. Ireland were incredibly lucky in that instance where Seamus Coleman lost his man not to concede. It was a brilliant piece of goalkeeping from Darren Randolph that saved our blushes. And that came from Seamus Coleman having no pace and losing his man, having no sense defensively. That was a couple of minutes to add a time at the end of the first half. We were really lucky not to be 1-1 at that point of the game. And the last instance I want to look at is about 20 minutes to go.
You've got another hater on the line there, Adrian.
At about 20 minutes to go, this is Seamus Coleman that you can see circled there. He's again got into a really good position, wide out on the right-hand side. It's Robbie Brady, as usual, that's just on his left shoulder there, that's played in that pass. And Coleman here is obviously looking to either play in, I think that might be Jeff Hendrick just ahead of him, or give it back to Brady. And what actually happens is he ends up clipping the ball off that Georgia defender that's just about to close in there. Again, can't get his pass away. They're the facts of what happened with Seamus Coleman in this game, and that's the reason I'm giving him 4.5 out of 10.
Well, that was a unbelievably embarrassing hatchet job.
Okay, well, get on with the reasons behind it. Stop this hyperbole. Get in with
what. That is not.
That's just a fact.
Taking snapshots of a split second of a game is not analysis of the full 90 minutes.
I've just explained to you that I've watched the entire 90 minutes and I've analysed what the positive impact that he had in the game, the negative impact, and then either one or the other. So obviously I wasn't going to go through all 49 involvements that he had over the course of the game and pluck each of them out. I'm trying to demonstrate that Seamus Coleman is not the player that he once was. You have to accept that.
Firstly, you're saying the Seamus Coleman that was linked with Manchester United. That Seamus Coleman was never based on his performances for the Republic of Ireland because he's never been able to get up and down the wing for Ireland like he has for Everton because he doesn't have as good players inside him. He got up and down that wing better than I've ever seen him do for Ireland on Tuesday night. And calling them two-bit players that Georgia offered nothing is showing a total lack of awareness of what Georgia have done in international football over the last 5 or 6 years. We went to Tbilisi 2 years ago and Georgia had 80% possession.
But we're not talking about the game the other night. Now you're talking about other games.
No, the reason they didn't have the 80%
possession. There's not a lack of awareness.
Players like
Seamus
Coleman put the pressure on the Georgians, set a tempo, got at them, didn't give them a second.
But this is just vague stuff that, you know,
this nonsense of, oh, Darren Randolph didn't roll the ball out to him. What are you trying to suggest? That Darren Randolph doesn't trust Seamus Coleman and he trusts Enda Stevens?
Okay, flip that around. Do you think it's surprising that not at one point during the game the goalkeeper would roll the ball out to his right back? Do you think that's in any way surprising?
Not if that was part of the game plan.
Can we, obviously we've got two good football men arguing here, but can we go to our chief football man, John Giles, to hear about his analysis last night?
Yeah, I think it's the best we've played in the last 10, 12 matches in Dublin. There was a bit of life about it, a bit of go about it. McGoldrick was good up front. I thought Coleman was outstanding.
He said he was outstanding, and let's hear, he had another clip on Seamus Coleman as well. Have a listen to this.
That's why we call them midfield, because they're the connection between back and front. And if they're not doing the stuff, then the lads at the back won't get to the front. I know that sounds a bit complicated, but it all depends on the midfield players getting on the ball, which we did. And it freed. And Coleman would be making the runs, because that's what he does. He does that naturally. But if the midfield players are not doing this, he's not going to get the ball. So therefore, people say, oh, Coleman didn't play as well as he has been. But it's because he's not getting the supply. But he did get the supply the other day, and I thought he was outstanding. Stevens was outstanding on the left-hand side of the field. But I think Coleman was back in the last two matches, was back to his very best.
John Giles never minces his word, says Seamus Coleman was outstanding.
Hardly got any supply, by the way. Most of the Irish attack went up the left-hand side.
No, it didn't. It most certainly did not. A huge amount of the Irish attack came up the right-hand side. You even showed the opportunity there where, in fairness to Coleman, it was a bad dink over the top, where McLean made the run short to the near post.
Are you standing over the fact that this was a top 10 Seamus Coleman performance? Seriously?
For the Republic of Ireland, yes. No, I think part of that is that we haven't seen the best of Seamus Coleman, unfortunately, in an Irish jersey, for the reasons that John Giles outlined, that we've never
fully been able to utilise him. So it's somebody else's fault, it's not Seamus Coleman's fault.
Well, Seamus Coleman is our best player, has been our best player playing at the highest level for the last 10 years. He's the one player who's consistently played in a top 10 team in the Premier League. There's a reason why he has struggled to get to the heights that he played with Everton for Ireland, because the players around him haven't been able to get the best out of him. It's a very different thing playing for Everton at right back. You get the ball, you play it into Andre Gomez in midfield. You know you can make your run up the right-hand side and you'll get it back to you. You won't lose it. Coleman hasn't had that level of trust. So I think if you're just randomly picking holes, and the reason I call it a hatchet job is, you go through that game on Tuesday night. I thought Glenn Whelan played very well, Conor Hourihan, Jeff Hendrick. You go through Glenn Whelan's performance bit by bit, minute by minute, you're going to see he gave the ball away in pretty dangerous positions 4 or 5 times. Now, more often than not, he won it back. But if you break down any player's performance into split seconds, into one moment here and there, so Seamus Coleman handed the defender off to Shane Duffy. It's probably the right thing to do in that situation.
I don't think that, having looked at that specific incident, I was open to the idea, absolutely. I don't think that's what happened. I think he was caught for pace. And like what you're saying is that when Seamus Coleman is good, that's down to Seamus Coleman, but when he's bad, it's somebody else's fault.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's a reason why he has struggled to get to the same level at club, at international level, that he does at club level, because he can trust the central midfielders more at club level than he can for Ireland. But that changed. That was the big difference, that actually for once, Conor Hourihan, Glenn Whelan, Jeff Hendrick got on the ball, dominated possession, were comfortable in possession, which allowed him to get forward, which allowed Enda Stevens to get forward on the other side and not fear that they were going to be caught out of position. It was a very good performance from Seamus Coleman. I don't know where you were sitting, what free seats you got, how much free red wine was consumed that somehow coloured your view of this game.
Nonsense.
But this was not
this
a
This is the sort of nonsense. And this is the refuge of somebody who's lost the argument, Nathan.
No,
nonsense.
No,
this is total nonsense. I watched the guy. The second half, I went. He was on the same side as the touchline as I was, and that was where the initial analysis came from. I watched the game back. I've gone in with an open mind. I haven't led the jury in terms of the facts. I'm saying that I'm willing to praise him where it needs be, but obviously for the my point of view is that he had a poor game from an Irish perspective, and I've demonstrated to you why. You haven't,
so
other than
all,
say
for all,
oh, he's
for
these
all
things
those
that
mistakes
somebody
Seamus
else's fault
made, for all those mistakes he made, for all those negative influences he had in the game. How many goals did Ireland concede?
Well, I mean,
our
that
right
was
back,
obviously...
He had such a horror show. He had such a horror show of a performance.
Nah.
Yet still, somehow,
Georgia
didn't
two
manage
Bob
to take advantage
Rovers.
Of us.
That's nothing to
playing.
Do with how Georgia might have done previously. As
Bob
you yourself
Rovers.
Pointed out during the week, they were missing some of their best players. What we saw on Tuesday night was two Bob Rovers.
Absolutely not. Sure, look at the chances they created in the second half as Ireland started to run out of steam. This was a Georgian team who frustrate the life out of you. They're never going to win a European Championship. They're never going to top a group like this. But their entire role is to frustrate the life out of you. Ireland didn't let them do that. Ireland played a lot better against Georgia on Tuesday night than Switzerland did in Georgia last Saturday. This was a very good Irish performance that we should actually, for once, enjoy a refreshing Irish performance. It's bizarre that you would identify one figure and try and nail him, considering you look at some of the other sports where we've disappointed over the past month, and I haven't seen any sort of hatchet job at any individual Irish rugby player.
This is
you.
Not, you're wondering, last, this is the absolute the refuge that, of somebody who's totally lost the
that
argument.
Point,
that's bullshit.
On that point, the 26th of May 2018, like we talk
come
about
on, listen, this is bullshit.
Tweets, Adrian
no,
Barry,
no, no,
incredible
no, this is nothing
team.
To do with
never
this,
seen the light.
Nothing to do with this argument.
In any sport, it's possibly, bullshit. Superb all
this
day,
is a hatchet job.
Told.
This is a hatchet, cheap shot, cheap shot.
Was it the same seats you were sitting in last week, or did they sit you up a little bit higher so you're a bit pissed off?
Cheap shot. This is a hatchet job. What I've done, by the way, and I need to clarify it, is not a hatchet job. I've watched the game live, in person. I've re-watched the game afterwards to look at Seamus Coleman. I wasn't looking at Glenn Whelan. I clearly said that at the start
but
of the game.
But that
piece.
Is my exact
That's
point.
What
Why
I was
weren't you looking
because,
at Glenn Whelan?
Because the discussion was about Seamus Coleman. Am I not entitled to go back? Why are we so prissy about whether that Seamus Coleman has not had his best ever game in an Ireland shirt?
Because it's such a bizarre target
Why?
To take.
Am I not allowed,
a game
is,
like that where
is one not entitled to look at the game and analyse a player's performance?
You perfectly are, and you're entitled to say that you felt it was a 4.5 out of 10 performance, but we're perfectly entitled to say you're talking absolute nonsense.
Well, you are entitled to say that, but the evidence that I've proven is that you're wrong.
You can go through every single performance from every Irish player and pick out your negative moments throughout a game, and they'll all be into double figures. Because that's the flow of a game. David McGoldrick, as brilliant as he was, he gave the ball away 5 or 6 times, couldn't control it, lost out when he was caught in tight corners. That's what happens. But you're looking at little moments of Seamus Coleman, freeze frames, and picking them out as...
No, but I'm trying
some,
to... No, 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 don't misrepresent, what, I, don't misrepresent what I'm doing. I'm looking at Coleman's performance and trying to analyse it and demonstrate. Rather than... If I came on here and said, listen, here are my thoughts on how he went without proving it with... graphics, you'd say, wow, this is just nonsense. That was just, did that really happen? So that's why it was proven. Some reaction in Nathan that you'll be delighted to hear. Was at the game, Coleman was bang average. One response here. Have to agree with Adrian. Coleman is nowhere near his old self. Doherty will be in except for Coleman being captain. And I don't discount the captain aspect. I totally get that. Mm. I understand all of that. Didn't think Coleman was great. Wouldn't go as hard as Adrian, but couldn't understand what all the praise was about. 6 out of 10 performance at the absolute max. Says another commenter here on YouTube. Coleman is but a shadow of the player he was, says Virginian on Twitter. So look, that's a bit of a flavour of the response, which...
It's a very one-sided flavour.
Well, it is, and it is. That's pretty much all the
response.
It's pretty much all the response we've had, to be honest with you, and they all seem to side with me.
I would say on the Matt Doherty argument, listen, it's Mick McCarthy's choice. It's a 50-50, I would imagine, but because of Seamus Coleman's experience, and I think Mick McCarthy said after the game, he's the man in possession. Something happens, Matt Doherty gets in, he'll be the man in possession, and Coleman will have to somehow try and oust him. But Matt Doherty's going to be on a hiding to nothing when he plays for Ireland. You might end up doing something very similar for Matt Doherty when we play Denmark if he's in the team. Because the Matt Doherty that plays for Wolves is never going to be able to replicate that performance for Ireland, because he has two of the best central midfielders in the Premier League inside him. He can do what he wants. He knows that they're never going to lose the ball. He can go 30, 40 yards up the pitch. When he plays for Ireland, he's going to be your regular right back, sitting inside his own half, no great opportunities to really bomb forward. And people are going to be disappointed by Matt Doherty, even though they shouldn't be. And I think that is the same situation with Seamus Coleman. Understandably, he's lost half a yard of pace with the injury and with the very fact that he's into his 30s now. But he's a smarter player. He's an intelligent guy. He's learned how to do it in a slightly different way. And he certainly, at club level, is not the reason for Everton's decline in form either. He had a very good game, I thought. One of his better games in an Ireland jersey. Offered more going forward.
And you're relenting to go from the top 10 of all time.
No, I think it is in his top 10 Irish performances, because I think he has never hit the heights for Ireland that he has at club level. You know, his best Ireland performance was probably France in the last 16 of Euro 2016, where he sort of, right from that very first minute, controlled the Irish performance, led from the front, made sure we played football in the right way, much like what happened on Tuesday night. The disappointment with Coleman over the years for Ireland is that we've never seen him get forward to the byline and the end line like he did on Tuesday night. He did that. There wasn't maybe that. I think Ireland in general lacked a little bit of quality in the final third. But that's going to continue during this campaign. We don't have a Robbie Keane. We don't have players in that final third who are playing at the very highest level at the moment. But to suggest that this was some sort of stinker from Seamus Coleman is just nonsense.
Your opinion, it was an absolute stinker. I've proven the facts. Something that we actually value your opinion about, Nathan, would be Liverpool-Tottenham at the weekend.
Yeah, can't wait. With Brian Kerr, 4:30 kickoff. It's funny, usually these international breaks, you don't look forward to them at this time of the season because the Premier League's in full flow and there's such an exciting title race. It's been a really interesting international break and we have to sort of turn our attention back to what's going on. It's a huge weekend for Liverpool because City, you would expect, will win quite comfortably against Fulham tomorrow lunchtime. Liverpool at home, unbeaten in almost 2 years at this stage, 36 games unbeaten at Anfield. Think back to the game last season when Mo Salah scored this ridiculous goal in the final minute, and then Harry Kane, having just missed the penalty, gets a penalty about 6 minutes into injury time to equalise for Spurs. It's generally a very good game. They're two technically exciting teams. They're not going to sit back. They're going to go at each other. I'd imagine there'll be plenty of goals. Liverpool somehow need to get the win on Sunday, and then they've Chelsea to come in Anfield at a fortnight's time. If they can remain within a point or two of Manchester City after those two games, they'll be delighted, because City then have United to come after that. But generally, Liverpool-Spurs is one of the better games of the season. And if they can get Mo Salah after his little break, Jurgen Klopp allowed him to go off on a holiday, relax, put the feet up, maybe just get into a sort of zen-like state.
You could do a bit of that yourself, Nathan, I would suggest. When are you back at Everton next to interview Seamus Coleman, by the way?
Well, funnily, we're at Everton Sunday week, and I'll be sure to pass on your kind regards.
I'm sure he'll speak to you now. That's the you know, you've stood up for him. I'm not saying anything.
Well,
enjoy the.
I look forward to tuning in next Friday if Munster or Leinster don't win this weekend, and
this is the sort of typical guff.
Who's it going to be?
Misrepresentation, cheap shot. Good luck.
Peter Romati, I hope he has a good game tomorrow. Otherwise, Adrian Barry's coming from.
Nix him off the line there. Goodbye, Nathan. Thanks a million for taking the call. Obviously, a busy household as well, so do appreciate you taking the call. What's your hot take on that?
Kind of speechless, to be quite honest with you. Stunned.
Stunned into silence.
Stuck for words.
I thought I did. I went into it with an open mind to... I had a prejudice, having been at the game, that I did think he had a stinker way beyond where people were giving him significant praise, including Mick McCarthy after the game, and that was the rationale. It wasn't to be a hatchet job. I don't believe what I've said there is a hatchet job, but I obviously am of the view that he had a below average performance, particularly from a Seamus Coleman capacity point of view, and I think I've put the facts out there.
Are you dropping him?
I'd like to have a look at Matt Doherty. Yeah, definitely would. Yeah, the point being, if Matt Doherty wasn't there, then we wouldn't even be having this conversation. It'd just be, well, there's nobody else there, so he's going to play anyway. So, yeah, I'd like to have a look at Matt Doherty, yeah, sure.
Mm. Brendan O'Brien is making the point in the Irish Examiner this morning that it's kind of like a Gerrard and Lampard situation with regards to two players in the same position and all that sort of thing. But obviously not comparing them to the level of performance they reached at club level or anything like that. But the one or the other sort of situation, which perhaps might have served England a bit better back in the day.
Right, we are nearly done here on this Friday morning, and to wrap things up, we're going to get into our mailbag, going through some of the best comments sent in to us this week on OTB AM. We want to hear from you, so you can tweet us, email us, Snapchat us, DM us on Instagram, comment on any of our live feeds or any of that stuff. You can even send us a voice note if you're into that on WhatsApp. The number there, 083-112-8154. That's 083-112-8154 if you want to drop us a voice note on WhatsApp. So, first topic, Joey Carberry and why he loves Munster. So here's our first comment that we can get into. Owen, you're probably better positioned there to read that.
Dasher Cronin has been in touch to say, Munster is an addiction. It's the Treaty Stone. It's the hurling team in summer and the fans on the way to Semple Stadium. It's the rugby team in winter on the way to Thomond Park. It's the history, the great players of the past in all codes. The wins, losses, failures, triumphs. Munster is more than a club or a code. Munster is a country and a city. It's the parts and the sum of the parts and the people, great and small, live there for a few years. And wild horses wouldn't drag you out of it. That's what Carberry has bought into. Connacht has this as well. Leinster doesn't. And then we have a response from Bearded Collie 39 that says, Leinster do have four European Cups though.
It's an argument I can get on board with. That was our first topic that we wanted to bring you in our mailbag. Second topic, the appointment of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And the first comment that's in here from John Fitzpatrick says, Pep has was slotted in as manager 11 years ago. Barcelona took a gamble, but had a good team and values they entrusted in him. He needed plenty of support, and I believe this is what United needed since Fergie departed. Ole will have plenty of ups and downs, plenty of them, and will need to acquire some key players over the next 2 years. Targets will be set, and I hope the United board will back him fully. Man United are a long way off Man City and Barcelona, but football teams go through cycles, and I think United are on an upward trajectory with this announcement. Good luck, Ole. A pretty long and thoughtful, I would say, comment there from John Fitzpatrick. And the reply to that then from Hammer saying, terrible decision in the long term. Pochettino was and is the man for the job. When United bomb at the start of next season, we'll see United in turmoil once again.
We should say that comment was edited so that commenter could have said that. Great decision from United before. He
right, that's the first couple of comments. Third comment that we're going to bring your way this morning is, objective achieved, thumbs up, says United, UEFA's problem child here on Twitter.
Sheep licker.
Thanks, Owen. Objective achieved, even more so with UEFA involved. My tennis ball just reached the 18-yard line, and it was the yellow one. Hashtag John Delaney, hashtag UEFA. And we can take a video of that here.
Rubbish. When we were doing great with John Delaney is a gentleman. It's only old talk, old politician rubbish. When we were doing great with John Delaney, he was a great man. Now he's a bollocks. It's all shite. Come out and support the country, and that's what I say.
You don't think he should resign then?
No, he shouldn't resign. Why should he resign?
That's our commenter of the week. A load of old bollocks.
Is that sheep liquor?
No, it wasn't actually. I may have suggested that in the...
I thought off the ball reporters had gone out to actually track down that sheep liquor and find out what he actually has to say with a microphone in his face. But it seems that they're in concert with one another.
Enjoy the weekend.
Thank you very much. What are you doing for the weekend again? Oh, you're going to get emotional while watching Leinster tomorrow?
I probably will, yeah. I mean, depending on how the game goes, of course. You want to preempt these things.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get emotional watching Kerry been beaten at the weekend.
Yeah, well, I'll be at the Aviva Stadium as well tomorrow.
Oh, will you?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, how's it taking us this long to get to this point of fact?
Yeah, I'm working tomorrow though, so.
All right. Good man.
Yeah.
Who do you root for in that dynamic?
Who do I root for in that dynamic? Yeah. I guess it depends how the game is going.
I presume you're anybody but Leinster.
Used to be. Like, yeah, I mean, last week. It used to be the case where certainly Munster people would kind of get shamed by the fact that they wouldn't get up for Leinster as much as Leinster would get up for Munster back in, whatever, the tail end of the last decade, for example.
Mm.
Has that shifted recently? Maybe, like, since the Carberry thing, I think I've my opinion towards
you're
it.
You're like, ah, this great province, they keep giving us players. Like, I can't feel anything other than
as a feeder province to Munster, I think you have to have some sort of kind of like tap them on the head saying, good job.
Feeder province. I mean, that is the total misrepresentation.
Get on your way.
That you're stealing some of the best players. You know, we're giving you, we are the, we're providing the entire nation with amazing players, obviously.
Well,
sometimes we'd like some of them back. is the thing.
One thing I know for sure is I shan't be drinking red wine, and I shan't be getting emotional tomorrow afternoon in the Aviva Stadium, but I sure hope you are in that cohort once again.
Thanks, Owen.
Watch the greatest team possibly ever in any sport ever we've ever seen. We've never seen the likes.
That was a hatchet job, by the way. That was totally irrelevant and unrelated to the conversation we were having. That was the only hatchet job that happened here this morning.
But it's not a hatchet job. I got a screenshot.
But it was totally unrelated to the conversation. Nothing to do with it.
Sure, it's not a hatchet job if you have a screenshot, Adrian.
It's shoehorning in something that is totally unrelated to try and misrepresent a point of the conversation. But look, I mean, I accept that they're the colleagues I work with. That's such as life.
Well, great to catch up with you about your weekend. I hope you have a great one.
We're back at OTB AM on Monday morning with Maura Trassin and Callig will be in the hot seat. She'll be joined by Anthony Moyles. Ger and Owen are both off on Monday.
Yes, that's true. If it's Maura Trassin joined by Anthony Moyles, the chance is that
he's celebrating
two of us
long into the night.
I have a couple of days to take back. So I said amazing.
That's not really. Nobody's interested in the context of why you have days off, but they're fascinated as to what you might be doing.
I don't really have any particular plans, to be honest with you.
Right.
Look at Seamus Coleman over my shoulder there. It's time for us to go, Adrian.
Seamus,
the prying into my private life every week is absolutely sickening.
Well, people give people what they want. We'll have a Kerry Mayo preview. Noel Mead will be on for Friday Night Racing as well. The Crappy Quiz, Formula One chat as well. That's all coming your way tonight. And Off the Ball on the radio from 7 o'clock. We're live 1 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday. Leinster Ulster, that game, live tomorrow on the radio. You can hear Owen's insightful analysis alongside a panel of legends.
Mm-hmm.
Who are?
Apparently we're going to it's going to
that's your cue
tomorrow.
Tell us who they are.
You have the script in front of you to actually
I don't have any
show.
Names on it though.
Do you not? Alright. Bernard Jackman is among the
I actually don't think he is
amongst the names go. On
I think he was, but I don't think he is now. Leinster Ulster live on the radio tomorrow, exclusive commentary of that Heineken Champions Cup quarter final with a panel of legends who will be revealed tomorrow. And then, as Nathan mentioned earlier, Liverpool Tottenham live on Sunday at 4 o'clock. Have a good weekend. Good luck.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.